Explorers, welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooke Fagney. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are and why we are here and what we may become if you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we watch X-Grid. Did you know you have existed for many thousands of years? The thought of reincarnation escapes most people, as it did me until I read this book. Your never-ending life is the first in the Universal Learning Series from Sandy Andrew. Search your higher mind, find your soulmate, and know that you are never alone in this world. The treasures of the eternities are yours, and your first step is to read the book. Quit the Banner for Your Never-Ending Life by Sandy Andrew at X Squared Radio, and order the book today. The foundations of religion and science were used to restore knowledge lost for over 6,000 years in our first book. The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, called 2012 and Harvest of the End Times, brings us vital knowledge for the race of mankind. Have the Watchers returned? What did the Aztecs mean by their ancient predictions for the year 2012? Why is Earth changing so rapidly now before our very eyes? Who were the Shining Ones who lived on the Earth and worked with mankind as they recovered from cataclysm? Who are we? Where did we come from? If you could find a book that answers just one of these questions, you'd buy it. Now there are two of the series that is sweeping the world with its message. Go to arcofmillionsofyears.com. Get your autographed copy today. Now, also available in full audio version. Welcome to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. Just want to let you know, tonight the solar wind is a light 353.9 kilometers per second. Sunspot 940 is still alive and came around as predicted. But against most predictions, it does not pose a threat for solar flares. Comet McNaught is still visible, even though it competes with the moonlight tonight. However, it's only visible to our friends down under and not in North America. So if you want to see Comet McNaught, you're going to have to catch a plane for Sydney. It seems my assertion 20 years ago that he who controls space controls the world is true, after all. Iran has converted a 30-ton ballistic missile into a satellite launch vehicle that will be used to send a satellite into space soon, a move that could have wider security implications, Aviation Week and Space Technology magazine reported on its website Thursday. Just want to let you know a couple of upcoming events. We have the Conscious Life Expo coming up February 9th, 10th, and 11th in Los Angeles. You can still make it there. Not expensive to attend. A lot of great names are going to be there. George Yuri, Richard Hoagland, many others. And I will be speaking Sunday night. Hopefully, you will be able to make that lecture and learn all about the North Pole Inner Earth Expedition coming up later this year. Also, make sure to make your way to X Squared Radio's website at x2-radio.com and pick up on the ET conference coming up at Mount Shasta in August and the Earth, Sky, and World Transformation Conference coming up in later August. Next week on X Squared Radio, we will hear from Robert Stanley. He has written a startling new book called UFOs Over Washington. He is amazed that evidence that UFOs have been responsible for more than 3,000 law enforcement reports, including numerous military scrambles since 2001, it has not raised the alarm to more people. His book and his interview will be reviewed next week on X Squared Radio. Trust me, Earth Explorers, he is very passionate about this subject, so don't miss the live interview and your chance to call in. As you might know, I have discussed in weeks past that I have been studying the subject of Merkaba meditation for about 3 months now. Besides being the most dynamic and useful meditation in modern and ancient times, it has given rise to many facilitators who are out there to help you learn it and other things. One of those facilitators is with us tonight. She is the author, writer, voice, and musical composer of the meditation CDs Rainbow Angel Meditation, Mantras for Ascension, Crystal Elohim Meditation, Fountain of Youth Volume 1, and the new 2-CD set, Sounds from the Great Pyramid. She is also the author of a new book called You Are the Genie in the Bottle. I have read it and have the pleasure of introducing her tonight on the program. Please welcome with me Maureen St. Germain. How are you this evening?
I'm very well, thank you.
How's the weather up in the North Country?
The North Country is a bit chilly. There's snow on the ground, but it's not snowing, and it's in the 30s here, a little chilly.
Well, that's balmy compared to Western Kentucky right now. I think with the wind chill, it's in the high teens or low 20s, and we had a little bit of snow today.
But, oh, my goodness.
It's getting there, yes. Being just, I don't know if we call ourselves the South or the Midwest, I'm not really sure, but we're just south of the plains of Indiana. So whatever they get in Chicago usually blows down our way. Anyway, it's still chilly, even deep beneath the earth here in Western Kentucky. I'm curious. I took a class from Drunvalo Melchizedek a couple of weeks ago, and I'm curious how you came across the Flower of Life workshops and became inspired to be a facilitator.
I originally discovered the Merkaba work in an ad that I saw in a magazine, and then at the Tai Chi Center that I was going to, there was an announcement, and then there was a third piece of mail that came my way, and I remember saying, all right, already, I'll do it. And it was an inquiry class, because when I took this work back in 1993, there were classes that were a week long, 12-hour days, and you committed to that amount of time, and it was quite a bit more money than what we charge today. And so it was a big investment, and in order to make a decision on an investment like that of time and money, they offered what was called an inquiry class, and it was a two-hour free class where you would discover a little more about the teacher, Drunvalo, and find out about what people expected to learn. And while I was attending that class, I knew from the moment I heard Drunvalo speak that I wanted to be a facilitator. And another lady asked the question, you know, what does it take to become a facilitator? And the man who was leading this class said, oh, well, we're not training any more facilitators. You know, we already have over 100, and we want to make sure that they have plenty of work. And I remember not even paying attention to that answer. And in my workshop that I attended, there was a woman who was already trained, but she was in my class. So I said to her, why are you in this class if you've already taken the facilitator training? And she said, well, my certification isn't complete until I take the course one more time as an observer. So when the course came around a few months later, a second time, I had the time and the money, and I invested again. And the man, same man, said to me, why are you here? And I didn't want to hear him tell me you can't do this, so I blew him off. And he said, no, I really do want to know why you're taking it again. Didn't you get it the first time? And I said, oh, no, I got it. But it's my intention to become a facilitator. And he started in with his rhetoric, and when he finished, I said, you know, I know that's your reality, but I choose a different one for myself. And 9 months later, I was certified. They reopened the program, and a number of people went through it, and I was one of them, and I was trained by Drumbo, and kind of like the rest is history.
Well, I took the class myself up in D.C., and I've been to several workshops, and to tell you the truth, I was completely amazed at the length of the days. I mean, you start up around 8:30 in the morning, and you go until 9 o'clock at night, and the breaks that you take are really not scheduled. They're just sort of in between sessions. And the work is, although very fulfilling, it's quite draining. I mean, when you sleep at night, you sleep hard because you do a lot of stuff during the day. And I'm, you know, as a student, you go through a lot. But you have to imagine that the instructor himself, Drumvalo, goes through a tremendous amount of energy in a day, holding a microphone and talking all day long and leading people.
When I started teaching, I was still working full-time as a lobbyist, and I would come back on Monday morning for a staff meeting and have so much energy that even my boss was amazed. Could not imagine what I could possibly be doing teaching on a weekend and come back with more energy than anybody else in the whole organization.
Isn't that amazing? Mm-hmm. And that's what I meant when I said that the flower of life, the Merkaba meditation, is so useful. It's not a meditation that drains you or takes you out of reality. It actually involves you in reality, and you actually are on the creation end of it, which is quite exciting.
Yes, it is, especially for A-type personalities who can't sit still for very long. It's a perfect tool because it gives you so focused and so attentive to the details that you are being given that you don't have time to be busy wandering off on some little mind trip.
Sure.
Yeah.
When some of my more pragmatic friends say, well, you're going off to bliss out. And when I come back even more dynamic and more focused and more productive and less wasteful than before, they get curious about the class. And you know, one of the things a student of the Flower of Life will learn is that the individual person is actually God. You know, that is to say, they are a part of the source of God consciousness, if they choose to be. And I want to explore how people become the creator of their own realities. One of the choice sets I have run across in my studies is this. We give a test to prospective candidates for employment. And we ask them, if you have a choice of five choices, one is that your life is 100% destiny, or your life is 70% destiny and 30% choice, or 50-50, or 30% destiny and 70% choice, or whether their life is 100% their own choices. I'm amazed at the answers that I get. Even with the most dynamic people, they very rarely say that their life is 100% their personal choice. Why do you think that is?
I think it is because they are indoctrinated into believing that that is so, and it is through a process of self-discovery and discovery of the universe around them that they realize that it's not so. And the more one just chooses to explore this, the more it becomes abundantly clear. I kind of joke around in my genie class with people, and I say, you know, DNA is like autopilot. Everybody comes in with a structure. Everybody comes in with a set of plans to run in case you decide to not be present. But as soon as you decide to be fully present and take the wheel, you are totally 100% on a place of choice and not destiny.
It's kind of a different planet, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. It really is.
Some people, they go through life thinking that they are acted upon by their universe. They believe in good luck and bad luck. And some people realize that there's no such thing as luck, that they make their own situations, their own positions. And I got to ask, what is it that people must learn first in order to become self-aware, that they, in fact, can choose their own reality?
Well, as one of my most beloved teachers taught me, it isn't how many times you fall down, but whether or not you get up. So the decision is always in the hands of the individual. No matter what happens to them, what will they do next?
Wow.
So, yeah.
Well, that's profound. A lot of people fall down a lot, and I'm often told in sports, the player that fumbles the ball the most is the one that carries the ball the most.
That's true in business as well. It's a known fact that people who make the most mistakes are also making the most mistakes, are also making the most successes, because they're out there making decisions. They're willing to risk.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Well, that's what it's about, I guess, in life, is how much risk are you willing to take? How much risk do you understand in your mortal life?
Yes. And so then that begs the original question, which was, how much do we have of choice and how much do we have of not choice? And the answer is based on risk. We consciously choose to not risk on occasion because it pleases us to not have a risk. And there are other times when we choose to go for what we believe in because we're willing to take the risk. And I think life is a healthy balance of that. You know, if we had 100% risk all the time, we'd have chaos. And so we need order, and we need direction, and we need stability. Those are the qualities of the male, really. And we need the risk and the adventure and the changeability, which is the feminine.
Yeah, and when we get used to one risk, then that becomes order, and then we go to the next level and take the next highest risk.
Exactly.
So,
exactly.
I can see that. It's not necessarily thrill-seeking. It's more stretching your muscles. Well, when I have...
Go ahead. In a lot of management organizations, risk appears to be risk when it really is well-informed choice. And one of the things that I believe is that anything that has been conceived of can be repeated. And so once it's in the reality as a possibility, then it can be replicated. And we have all kinds of stories of that in sports. You know, the story of the runner who broke the 3-minute mile and how no one believed it was possible. But here he was a doc, and he was also a runner, and he believed that the heart would not burst if he ran the mile in less time. And once he broke the record, 5 other people all over the world broke it within a few weeks.
Yeah, pretty amazing.
Yeah.
To finish a mile in less than 4 minutes is...
4 minutes. Thank you for the correction.
Yeah.
My mistake.
The only way to finish a mile in 2 minutes, I think, is to fall out of an airplane. You could probably do it in less than 2 minutes that way.
But you wouldn't be running, would you?
That would be a world record. I don't think that could ever be broken. I can't do 2 minutes in my SUV.
Well, you know, when you say never been broken, you know, I have heard of Aboriginal runners or runners in the rainforest who have been the message carrier, who somehow managed to run at speeds that are not definable. And in one case that I read of, and I wish I could tell you where I read this because I can't give you the location, the story goes that a particular runner was actually seen in a village at a time before he was supposed to have left.
Now, that's pretty amazing. That sounds like dimensional travel.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does.
I have a friend who plays the guitar better than any human I've ever seen live.
last year he was in a guitar contest. It was called Guitarmageddon. And I felt for sure he would win. And this 50-ish-year-old man came up there. We didn't expect anybody to touch my friend Larry. And the guy stepped up and began playing like Al Di Meola. And I remember the story of Al Di Meola, but the long story short is Larry lost because this guy got up there. He was a jazz musician, but his fingers were so fast that it just didn't seem human.
Hmm.
Al Di Meola was a little better than average guitar player, middle of the way through his life, and he went and studied with a teacher known as Carlos Castaneda, who's not a guitar player, by the way. And when he returned, within a phenomenally short amount of time, I'm thinking 30 days or so, Al Di Meola was reportedly the fastest guitar player in the world, and remains so. I don't think anyone has ever put the sequences and riffs together that he has. So it is about the mental processes that we run. It is about the limits that we set on ourselves that cannot be done or that's not humanly possible. You know, when I ask people about their dreams, I get the strangest answers, but most of the time they center around things like houses or rich husbands or fame or crazy things like being a talk radio host. But they rarely have a dream that has to do with process or things that will become eternal. What's the first step you would recommend to someone to overcoming this viewpoint?
To access what they really desire?
Yeah, or even discover a dream. You know, they may have been taught their whole lives to be completely rational, and they don't have dreams.
Okay, well, the process would be to write 500 things that they really want to do. And what happens is at a certain point, like at item number 11, the energy changes and they shift from what their first focus was. And then at item number 22, the focus shifts again. So by the time you get to 500, you've run out of the ordinary things and you have laid them out on the table. And when one lays them out on the table, then they've gotten out of the way for those that are at the subconscious level to emerge. And so the list of 500 once a year is quite profound and really charges you up for what your true potential is all about.
Wow, and you have them do this each year?
People who are working closely with me, yes. In a class, I go through a process where I set a number, you know, do this many right now. But as a practice, to answer your question, how do you get to that core value? How do you find out what it is I'm supposed to do? How do you get to, you know, what is it that I'd really like to do as a contributor to this earth, to be part of the process, to be part of life? And the answer is to make a list and to keep writing. And if you can do it in one sitting, that's the best. You sit down with your favorite cup of coffee or tea, you know, and whatever you need to be happy with pens and paper, and you write and write and write. And you don't get up at all until you're done. And it's huge.
Wow, 500 things, that's a lot. I can see getting to like 9 and saying, well, gosh, you know, what else is there? And
exactly.
Then you start stretching yourself, and then you erase, you think they're in numerical order, so you erase number 1 and move it to number 4. And
only take the perfectionists do that.
Okay, guilty. So do you think there's an order and intention behind what happens in one's life?
An order and intention behind what happens in the classroom?
Behind what happens in a person's life.
Well, yes. As a matter of fact, I think that we come in with certain goals and desires, certain contracts, certain decisions that we have made for ourselves. And we come in with certain patterns, certain proclivities, certain attitudes. And then throughout the process, you know, we have a chance to rewrite the contract. I tell people they have a contract with the universe. And so if you don't like what's going on, then you rewrite the script or you rewrite the contract. And there's nothing wrong with changing your mind. You might have come in with a decision to do something a certain way or to be with a certain partner, and it's okay to change your mind. What's not okay is to act outside of whatever those contracts are and not own the fact that you've changed your mind or deny the fact that you've changed your mind. And that's where people start to live out of integrity. And I personally think that the life lived in integrity is the life that gives us the most fulfillment, because then we can move forward without regret.
Well, so when you're talking to someone who maybe their life is in chaos, or they feel like it's in chaos, and they are advised to or inspired to take your workshop, and they come, you know, what's the first thing that you expose them to when they come in and say, okay, how am I going to make order out of chaos?
Well, in the Merkaba class, the way we do that is we give people specific opportunities to say who they are, why they're there, and why are they really there. And right away, the first mask gets taken off, and they're given permission to be who they want to be. And then sometimes, depending upon the energy of the group, sometimes on the next day, when after we do the opening prayer, I'll say, okay, who do you want to be today? You know, you don't have to be the person you told us yesterday. In fact, we can even call you a different name if you'd like. And in my longer classes, like when I do a dolphin swim in the Merkaba workshop, very often we do that. We play that way, and we say, well, today I really feel like being Henry instead of, you know, Susan. And it's quite fun, because people get to explore another way of being who they'd like to be.
That reminds me of two guys at a 30-year class reunion who happened to be single, going around telling people they're Jack the mountain climber, or they're Todd the corporate attorney, or they're trying to see what kind of action they can get. That's the input that you give to them. When they echo back to you, when they duplicate back to you, do you have any special experiences when teaching people personally about when they actually hear for the first time that they are creators?
Well, this is an interesting experience, because people don't actually hear it as if it's spoken to them. It's more of a discovery and a self-realization.
Uh-huh.
And as that becomes integrated, as they come to their senses of that, sometimes there's disbelief. But because it came from within them, because it welled from within them, it's undeniable. And when I teach people to discover their inner guru or their inner guardian or the higher self, it's always a delightful surprise to see what they discover, what their experience is, and how that can impact them for the rest of their life. I was teaching a class in Paris a few years ago, and a woman contacted me, sent me an email in Paris, and said, you know, I want to meet you for lunch. I was in your class in New York City a few years ago, and I'd like to buy you lunch. I'm living in Paris now. So I met with this woman, and she said to me, I want to thank you for teaching me how to connect with my higher self and how to use that as a tool, because I have found when I am in my business, in my situations at work, I can make decisions based upon guidance that I get from my higher self. Even when the people around me say, you know, that's not worked in the past, if I get a green light or some kind of, you know, yes, clarity from my higher self, I can proceed with absolute sureness, and it's always right. And they've come back to me and said, how can you know this? How can you know this will work when we tell you it won't? And she says, my higher self. And I wanted you to hear it.
Yeah, and, you know, they're actually running a creation sequence in their minds, right? And I was meaning to ask you, how many different kinds of creation are there?
Well, I think there's really two basic kinds of creation. One that is masculine, which is precise and defined, and one that is feminine, which is a global and broad brush strokes and undefined. Like, if you ask me for a creation mode that would be a feminine one, I would say, well, it would be grandma's favorite gravy recipe, and You add a little flour, a little pan drippings, a little vegetable broth. And by this time, you're thinking, how much? Just tell me how much. And a meal program would be something that's very precise. But even before that, I emphasize a direct connection with the higher self so that as you learn the Merkaba, you have the ability to check in with your inner wisdom, your higher self, so that any creation sequence you come up with, any program you come up with, is according to the highest good. Because the work you can do at the level of the Merkaba is so evolved that even you and I, in our ultimate wisdom, could come up with some kind of a creation sequence that might not be in my highest good or your highest good. And the only way to know that is to check in with the wisdom from our evolved self.
I see. Now, assuming that, let's just take me for example. I'm a man, and I go to the Merkaba meditation. I learn how to get in touch with my higher self in this style of meditation, with this kind of energy field around me in my heart.
Mm-hmm.
And assuming that my higher self is also male and comes to me, and I'm going to get directions like a cup of this and a gram of that and 4 feet of this, and not a global, more esoteric, more emotional advice. How do I make use of, say, right brain, left brain, or masculine, feminine sources of creation?
Well, amazingly, not everyone's higher self is the same gender that they are.
Uh-huh.
Some of the people in my class, the higher self is the opposite gender. Some people experience their higher self as a genderless or androgynous being, and some experience their higher self as an energy of light. So there is no gender. Now, with regard to your first part of the question where you said, you know, can I actually get precise measurements? Yes, you can, and I often do. And there are people that I work with that get precise information, which is quite amazing, quite amazing. I was doing a workshop the weekend in New York City, the weekend before 9/11, and I was told by my higher self when to go. I was told what city to go to and the dates. And when I went to buy my airline ticket, I thought, you know, I'd like to stay an extra day. I love New York City, and I think I'll take an extra day to play. And that would have had me return on September 11th on 2001. And when I went to buy my airline ticket, even though there was availability by the airline, my higher self was very clear that I had to go straight home. And I didn't know why. So I was on the very first plane I could get on that Monday morning instead of staying for that day and flying home Tuesday morning.
And was there a reason why? Did that turn out to be advantageous to you?
Well, I would not have been on one of the planes that had crashed, but I would have been caught in New York City, unable to get home for a week, and I had a workshop in another city the following weekend. And I had family at home that was counting on me to return. So it would have been extremely inconvenient. It would not have been my demise or anything like that. But that's one of the things that I teach people. When you develop this connection with the higher self and use the Merkaba, the combination allows you to be proactive in the reality instead of reactive. So reactive is sensing, gee, there's danger. Maybe I better drive slower. And proactive is you're getting a strong sense that you need to stop. So you stop, or you take a picture, or you get off the highway. And it's the idea that you're out of harm's way, so you're not even in it. You're in a proactive situation where you're not involved. And in my case, I was proactive. I was already home when 9/11 happened. And 24 hours earlier, I was 1 mile from ground zero.
Wow. Well, those are certainly coincidences that you have to mark down in your journal and write a few pages about. What about the person that's making a life change, or they've just graduated college, or they just got married, or they just got divorced, or they are starting a business, and they really need to tap into this creative process, because there may not be a book outlining exactly what it is they're trying to do. They're trying to do something that's never been done before. how do they tap into that creative energy that's out there so they can get this pure information?
Well, actually, I have written a book about this that hasn't been published yet. It is under contract with Hampton Roads Publishing, but and the book is called After the Flower of Life, and there is a very specific process that I teach. And when I took the Flower of Life, I will tell you that, what was said to me, which is very profound, is that if you're on the cusp of one of those big decisions, like you've just named, a marriage, a divorce, college, job, whatever, that you should wait to make that decision until after you complete this work, because your life will be so different. So the first thing I would recommend is to find a facilitator. Go to floweroflife.org and find a facilitator that can teach you the Merkaba, take the coursework, and begin to discover this new connection that you will build with your inner awareness, which is really another version of you that's more able to read the reality. My experience is that everyone is reading the reality, but we don't have a data set to interpret it, so we ignore it. You know, if we go stand in a room of Bulgarians and they're all speaking Bulgarian language and none of us know it, we might hear a few words if we know a Russian word that sounds familiar, but essentially we're going to start to ignore it and we'll just talk to each other in English. And so this is what happens. People are receiving data all the time, and we all know this is true because we get a pit in our stomach, we get a feeling, an uneasy feeling, you know, I don't like that guy, or I feel strange around this person, or something's not right here, you know, and you have a sense, but you have no way to interpret it because we have so discounted the intuitive knowledge, the information that's coming in this non-linear, non-ordered way, and so we discount it. What the Merkaba does is put us in balance. It balances the male-female aspects of it. It balances our mental and emotional bodies and our physical body and puts us in such a place of alignment that we're actually able to tap into our center, which is connected to God. And once we're tapped into that, we're able to begin to be more of who we really are. It doesn't happen overnight, but over the course of time, it's very, very profound. One of the most fun calls that I get is from the wife of a man who's taken the class, who says to me, I want what he got. I've never seen him change this much after a workshop. And if a wife is calling 6 months later to say, I want what he got, it says a lot. And I think men change the most from this work because it allows a man to tap into his intuitive side, and he's usually pretty good about tapping into his logical side, so he has a vehicle for full expression. Women are more tapped into their emotional intuitive side, so it isn't as likely to be obvious that she's expanded and grown her male side. It isn't as strongly noticeable, at least not to those around them. But over the course of time, people notice a difference. When you came back from your first Merkaba class, didn't people around you say there's something different about you?
Yeah, they certainly did. It was almost like, okay, what did you do with my husband?
Uh-huh.
You mentioned some things in there that I made some notes on. One was that we get all kinds of data in mm-hmm. our lives through our senses, either our eyes, ears, or even our intuition, and we routinely throw that out. I see that all the time in the scientific community as well. We form a hypothesis and we do experiments, and in those experiments we get inputs that are unpredictable, and usually what it does for me is I say, I need to go back and do an experiment to find out what that was and do some more exploration. But I see others who are kind of fixed on their goal and they just routinely throw that data out and then it's just lost forever. And the funny thing is you'll see the work of 10 or 12 different scientists and they all get this erroneous data and they all throw it out. And then you'll see some guy, the 13th guy, come along and gather up all the erroneous data, and he gets the Nobel Prize because he picked up all that data that was routinely thrown out. And the other was, you mentioned two words, linear and nonlinear, about creation. How does that apply to creation? How do you introduce people to linear and nonlinear creation?
Well, the way I do it is I teach people about simple things that they will understand and that they use every day. So I take a classic example of Newton's law, distance equals velocity times time. Everybody uses that when they drive somewhere. And they know that if they go 60 miles an hour over an hour, they're going to travel 60 miles. If they go faster, they'll get there faster. And I explain, you know, if you change one of the numbers on one side of the equation, it changes the result the same amount. In a nonlinear equation, it's more like an avalanche or a game of pickup sticks, where a series of inputs, each person picking up a stick or that snowball coming down the mountain, doesn't seem to be making a difference. And then all of a sudden, one person picks up one stick and everything changes, or the snowball suddenly grabs the whole mountain of snow and everything comes down. So nonlinear is input that doesn't appear to make a difference. And from what I understand in the scientific community, you probably know this better than me, the data that is part of that first part of that nonlinear equation is called negative feedback because it keeps the system in place and it appears to have no impact. And yet it does build until it hits critical mass.
Yeah, negative feedback is usually electronically or electromagnetically used to keep a system in stasis. When it tries to get hotter, it applies more cooling water. Or when it tries to go faster, it lets off a little bit on the energy to maintain a constant speed. It's a feedback loop. We use PIDs. We use all kinds of proximity sensors to pick up that data and feed it back into the system. It corrects it back to a single setting called a process variable. And I think we do that in our lives, too. We set up negative feedbacks for ourselves to avoid pain or to avoid financial loss or all kinds of things. But in nonlinear systems, where I got my first introduction to this, I was a programmer and I was trying to program a small PLC to control a motor to vary speed relative to exposure to ultraviolet light. The weakness in the system, I later found out, was that the PLC did not have a floating decimal point. So it kept rounding off the numbers back to about three places. And we found that, you know, infinitesimal changes in the milliamp signal that was coming back from the sensors made no change in the motor at all. It didn't move. And it was because the changes were being truncated. They were being shaved off and rounded up to where the change didn't occur. But when we allowed that decimal point to float, everything changed. Everything got a lot more sensitive, and we started seeing results that were fabulous.
And that's what a well-known mathematician named the butterfly effect.
And how did that work?
Well, the man was a researcher who was a mathematician and then became a weather forecaster. And after the war, after his training in the war of becoming a weather forecaster, he went to work for a research and development firm that wanted to write software programs. And the story goes that he chose to leave and come back. And when he came back, his program was run out of paper, and he reinserted the data and left a few decimal places off, and the results were dramatically different. And he went back and forth, so he found why this occurred, because it should not have showed up differently in his mind. It, just losing a few decimal places shouldn't have made a difference. And when he realized it did, that's when he wrote his paper that was called Can the flap of a butterfly's wing in one city change the weather in another city the next day? And the answer was yes.
Hence the butterfly effect.
Exactly.
That butterfly flapping its wings in South Africa can cause a hurricane in the Gulf of Mexico.
It's an amazing concept that really takes us away from cause and effect. And it's not as if cause and effect aren't real. It's just that there's more than one way that things occur.
Sure. Yeah, exactly. More than one way that things occur. So when your friend was advised by her coworkers, oh, we tried that before, we don't really think it's going to work, and she's in touch with her higher self, and her higher self is saying, no, there are actually more inputs that they didn't consider, and now those inputs are in place, it's actually going to work, and then it does. And then those people who are not in touch with those other inputs say, how in the world did you know that was going to happen?
Well, yeah, not only that, but the system can change in any given moment to be dramatically different than what it was when other people tried it. And the higher self is fully present in this current time and place. So whatever data you're collecting from your higher self is highly accurate for now.
Wow, that's great. I'm gonna come back to this in our second hour. I want to talk a little bit about in the second hour about you know, we are told to live in the here and now. We're even taught that by modern teachers, and if we do that, then we can lay our futures out. But in physics, and you probably know this because you write quite well about it in your book, You Are the Genie in the Bottle.
Thank you.
That we physicists do not delineate between the past and the future mathematically. The arrow of time goes equally in both directions. In other words, from my house to Nashville, Tennessee is exactly the same distance as it is from Nashville, Tennessee to my house. And mathematically, that's the way we try to look at time in physics. So I want to ask about people being able to go back and actually observe and thereby change the past and how that changes the present. But for now, I want to talk about the creation story a little bit more. The creation story most of us hear about is the one where God creates the universe from nothingness. And, you know, many of the ancient traditions, the Egyptians, even the Tibetan writings say that that's not exactly right, that there wasn't exactly nothingness. There was an awareness of a single consciousness, and then something happened. What is the first step of creation?
In my book, the first step of creation was the all and the nothingness, which is the same. Because if you are everything, you are also nothing. Because
correct.
There's nothing to know. So we start with that, and then we move to self-awareness. And from self-awareness, a desire to know more, to experience more than everything that is already known, becomes a process of going beyond self-awareness. And at that point, there's only one way to do that. At least this is what was, I believe, taught by the Egyptians and certainly my self-discovery, and that is to create a boundary. Because if you create a boundary, then everything that is inside the space is different and separate from everything that's outside simply by virtue of experience, because we now have everything that's inside of me and then everything that's outside of me, even though it's all me.
Right.
So we divide that which is undividable, and then creation can begin.
And then the next step is to do what?
The next step is to replicate what we have created. So we go to the edge of our boundary and we create again another boundary. And that creates the shape known as the Vesca Piscis, which is that almond shape, and it is the matrix of all other geometry shapes. It's the matrix that is well known as the womb. It is the threshold of all the creation forms, everything we know in traditional mathematics and science. And I believe it can actually be used as a tool to manifest.
Well, one of the things that you draw in your book, this division, this boundary, is in the form of a circle. And that means that square root laws apply. So if this circle is going to duplicate itself or replicate itself, and you're going to actually draw a circle whose diameter line is at the center of the other circle. So the two circles are the same size, but the tangent is the radius or the
mm-hmm.
center of each circle. And that forms this sacred geometrical shape you talked about, the vesica Did you call this a capicus?
I did, because it's singular. It's not plural.
Ah, okay.
And it's a sphere. It's not a circle. The circle is a 2D representation.
Very well done. I'm sorry my paper was two-dimensional. Next time, send me a three-dimensional book. I would have seen that.
Yes, and we'll make it pop out at you and come alive like they do in the movies.
Yeah, that's cool. I just scratch it and it goes 3D.
Right.
That would be, you'd win the Nobel Prize for that by itself. Mm. So you have a sphere, and the sphere does a division on itself. And I don't, some of my friends and I have sat around and we've pontificated on this, and we've decided that the sphere doesn't actually divide itself in two. It actually takes the square root of itself. And then what you get is a circle, or a sphere times a sphere equals the original shape. And if you want to keep that in the right ratio, then it is actually phi. It is actually 1.618, and that symbol, that Greek symbol, looks like two spheres divided in half. So, well, we liked it. I don't know if mathematically it's sound, but it seems to get us in the game. And so once these two spheres exist, now there is something to which each individual consciousness can compare itself. Now there is existence.
Indeed, and there's also a third part that is different from the whole in the part that's shared. The part that is mutually shared, that middle section,
right,
is completely different because it's a little bit of you, a little bit of me. But it's not complete in all of me.
Right.
It's got you in it too. So it's a point of creation.
So there's a common part, and then there is an individual part.
Indeed.
Now, what happens if we expand this creation process, say 19 times? What do we get?
We get the shape that's known as the flower of life, and it's the circle of circles.
Wow. Now I get a grasp of the two-dimensional version of that. I've seen people wear a piece of jewelry around their neck. I've seen it drawn on paper and on you know, tapestries and things like that. But I don't know if I can conceive of what the three-dimensional version of that looks like.
I think I would struggle with it, too. It's just, it's a pretty big deal. I can tell you that when we give, occasionally I've gone into an environment where we've given people a blank piece of paper and told them to bring their compass and to draw it, just to free, you know, to draw it however they want. And what's interesting is where they start and where they put it, we can actually interpret in terms of whether they're left brain dominant or right brain dominant, if there's something going on with them that's, you know, it's quite amazing. You would think something as simple as, you know, drawing circles wouldn't be that telling, but it is.
Indeed it is. Indeed it is. Listen, my guest tonight is Maureen St. Germain. Her great book that we're talking about is You Are the Genie in the Bottle. Can you tell our listeners how to get the book before we start our next hour?
Yes, they can go to my website, MaureenStGermain.com, or a shortcut to the website is Angle Angel, and it's because I'm all about angles and angels. ANGLE, Angle Angel.
Marvelous. Also, we're going to open up the phone lines in our second hour. So if you want to make your way to the phone, we definitely want you to call. And hang on a second, my screen just went on screensaver. Here we go, 877-876-5227, anywhere inside the United States. If you're calling from Canada, you can also call toll-free 888-810-8322. And anywhere else on planet or off planet or inside the planet, if you can reach a phone tower, you can get to us through 530-876-3222. And I definitely want you to make note of that website. If you'll just give me one moment, I'm struggling with a technical difficulty. Yeah, I finally got it to come up. Yeah, I love it when the electronics don't want to cooperate.
So it's angleangel, A-N-G-L-E-A-N-G-E-L.com, or MaureenSaintGermain.com. Both will get you to my website, which will give you the opportunity to buy the book.
Excellent.
You Are the Genie in the Bottle.
Excellent. Well, you can also go to X-Squared Radio at X2-Radio.com, go to the archives, access this program, and we will have the link to that on that website, so you can always reach Maureen from now until the end of time, because that's how long this radio program is going to be on here. And I really appreciate you coming on tonight. Don't forget, we'll be back as soon as we get to these messages. We'll take about a 6-minute break, and then we'll be back with more of X Squared Radio, Brooks Agnew and Maureen St. Germain. Did you know you have existed for many thousands of years? The thought of reincarnation escapes most people, as it did me until I read this book. Your Never-Ending Life is the first in the Universal Learning Series from Sandy Andrew. Search your higher mind, find your soulmate, and know that you are never alone in this world. The treasures of the eternities are yours, and your first step is to read the book. Click the banner for Your Never-Ending Life by Sandy Andrew at X Squared Radio and order the book today. There is something about to happen to the Earth. You know it. You can feel it. Well, the creators of the Kill Shot have collected the evidence for you in a stunning new documentary called The Horizon Project. The first DVD is now in print, and you can get it by clicking on the Horizon Project banner at X Squared Radio. Believe me when I tell you, this may be the most important video production you will ever see. This is destined to air on the Discovery Channel or the History Channel, but you need the uncut version. Click the Horizon Project banner at X Squared Radio and get your copy today. Many people write us here at X Squared Radio wanting to know how to get prepared for the coming cataclysms. Well, we have been successful in acquiring the best affiliate in the world for emergency preparedness. NitroPak has been around for 18 years and can provide everything you need for life. They have everything from 72-hour kits to a year's supply of excellent quality foods and supplements for a single person or a whole family. Don't be left without the essentials of life. NitroPak is the name. Click the banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared. The foundations of religion and science were used to restore knowledge lost for over 6,000 years in our first book. The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, called 2012 and Harvest of the End Times, brings us vital knowledge for the race of mankind. Have the Watchers returned? What did the Aztecs mean by their ancient predictions from year 2012? Why is Earth changing so rapidly now before our very eyes? Who were the Shining Ones who lived on the Earth and worked with mankind as they recovered from cataclysm? Who are we
where did we come from? If you could find a book that answers just one of these questions, you'd buy it. Now there are two in the series that is sweeping the world with its message. Go to arcofmillionsofyears.com and get your autographed copy today. Now, also available in full audio version. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio with a message for our friends in the radio broadcast world. If you have noticed that your listeners aren't around anymore, it's because they are right here with us. If you would like them back in your radio fold, then all you have to do is add X Squared Radio to your program content. Statistics don't lie. We are now the fastest growing talk radio program in North America. Don't be late, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio. Welcome back to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew, and here the results are always positive. Now, we might go a little past your imagination tonight, but have no fear. You are safely traveling with us. My guest tonight is Maureen St. Germain. Her book is You Are the Genie in the Bottle. Great read, easy to read, lots of room in the margins to make notes, which is what I have done. I finally figured out after I got out of college to quit using a black highlighter. I was losing a lot of information that way. But I got it figured out now. Underline the words. Don't draw through them. I want to let you know also that the Conscious Life Expo is coming up February 9th, 10th, and 11th in Los Angeles. If you're planning on going to an expo sometime this year, you might as well get started early. This one's not very expensive. If you're in the area, it would be advisable for you to come by. My friend George Dury, Richard Hoagland, several other very highly thought of conscious life lecturers. My good friend Nick Begich is going to be there. I'll be speaking on Sunday night on the North Pole Inner Earth Expedition for about 45 and a half minutes. You don't want to miss that. I'll be there shaking hands and signing books. I'll bring your book by if you've already bought it. If you haven't, I'll bring a case or two with me and see what we can do. You can call anywhere in the U.S. at 877-876-5227. Anywhere in Canada, 888-810-8322. Anywhere else, on planet or off planet, at 530-876-3222. And I'm still waiting for that off planet phone call, but we do make it available. We don't want to leave anyone out. We were talking about the Flower of Life sacred geometry, and I wanted to ask you if you knew how old that is on Earth.
You know, I don't know that anyone knows that answer. I'm glad you asked it. I mean, you know, you can trace it back to the ancient Chinese, but no one knows how old that Flower of Life symbol is on the temple at Dendera in Egypt. So it could predate, B.C. It could be 2,000 or 3,000 years old.
That's a really hard geometry to draw, even with a compass. I can't imagine somebody drawing that in stone and doing it on such a large scale and so accurately. Is that the oldest place or the only place that Flower of Life is found?
No, it's been found in China. It's quite old also. But no one knows how old it is. And, there, in my mind, the location where it's drawn in Egypt, it's on an upper column. So as you look at it, you think to yourself, why would they have put it up at the top? Why wouldn't they put it in the middle? Unless the ruins, because they were in the temple behind the temple, the earlier temple is the one that's partially submerged now in water, and it's on that those walls that you find the Flower of Life, and it's drawn near the top as if they had uncovered it and somebody thought to add it to the stones after that temple had no longer been used. You know, in Egypt, it's hard to comprehend because we're not used to this, but in Egypt, everything gets covered with sand, and they work daily to sweep it out and to keep it uncovered. I mean, that's why the story of the man who became Pharaoh was a man who slept under the Sphinx, and he slept under the head of the Sphinx because the sand was up to the Sphinx's neck.
Wow.
The story was that if he would sweep out, he had a dream, and in the dream he was told if he would sweep the Sphinx, uncover the Sphinx from the sand, that he would be made Pharaoh, and he had no lineage to deserved to be made Pharaoh. He did what he was asked to do in the dream, and he eventually became Pharaoh. And I can't tell you the name of the man who this was, but somebody knows, I'm sure.
Yeah, I'll bet my co-author, E.J. Clark, knows. She knows everything about ancient Egypt, I think. She says she's reincarnated from ancient Egypt. I can't doubt her. Some of the things that she comes up with and later turn out to be true. Well, let's... Okay, so the Flower of Life exists in several ancient civilizations. It's been drawn in its entirety on, for all intents and purposes, the most sacred edifices that they had in their society. And it is a representative of this nonlinear creation. And we've established that it is three-dimensional. But
I'm not sure it's not entirely nonlinear.
Ah.
And the reason I say that is because if you follow the process of first going from the all and then the nothingness to self-awareness, and then from self-awareness you draw a boundary, that's certainly the boundary as the sphere. It's extending yourself a certain distance to create that sphere. So that first motion is linear. And then when you go stand on the edge or the circumference, or the equator of the sphere, or the ball, you're also extending yourself again that same distance to create another one that creates the vesica. So I think there is both linear and perhaps nonlinear going on.
Wow, great. Well, listen, I believe we have a caller on the line. Caller, what is your first name and where are you calling from? I think the caller is listening on his computer. It takes about 15 seconds for him to figure out that he's on the line. All right, well, maybe we don't have a caller on the line, but I get IM messages, and by the way, if you want to access me without your voice, you can go to AOL Instant Messenger. My screen name is Vision Officer. I'm pretty easy to find. And I have a couple of questions, but they're a little more advanced than where we are right now, so I'm going to save them just a little bit. Some people might say that, well, that this is chaotic creation. Is there some sense of order about it? I mean, is there a synchronicity about it?
I think that there is a definite synchronicity and order, and the order is there for us to discover. And it's intrinsic in everything we do, and I believe that Phi, this magical 1.618 dot dot dot, is at the center point of it all.
Well, I think there is too, and synchronicity, at least for me, seems to connote that two different systems or two different individuals, or even the universe and the individual, can work together, can work in harmony somehow. And I think that caller might have made their way back. Caller, are you there?
Yes, I am, Dr. Brooks Agnew. Good evening.
Okay, and who are we speaking with?
This is Drew in Connecticut.
Drew in Connecticut. Welcome to the program. Do you have a question?
I do for Maureen. I have had the privilege of attending Maureen's advanced workshops in the Flower of Life. And mentioning synchronicity, our class at that time, when we found out why are we there, it was astonishing to learn how either a book popped out within a week, How the Flower of Life or Drunvalo's book was just magnetized or just evolved. And there we were in a weekend with Maureen in her fascinating class. I have had the privilege, too, of traveling to Egypt with her and seeing the Flower of Life symbol at Dendera. And I wanted to ask Maureen, regarding the Flower of Life and the Merkaba, how do you believe it is manifested in the 3D or on other dimensions? I think that's something that we use here on the 3D. We can't see it in the 3D, but yet it's sort of multidimensional. Is that the word I'm looking for? Is it maybe perhaps another dimension where we're actually carrying this in another person through the matrix?
Wow, that's a pretty advanced question.
Yes, and I hope I caught it all. It was a little faint for me to hear. First of all, thank you so much for calling in, Drew. It's always a pleasure to have you around, and he is an absolute treat to have on a trip. He is a brilliant, brilliant man and very funny also. I think the answer lies in the movie Contact, where Jodie Foster descended from that point, and there was this missing time that she didn't know was missing on the tape. Do you remember the end of the movie?
Right, the 18 and a half hours of missing time.
My experience is that the Merkaba itself is a fifth-dimensional tool, and that the dimensions are nested and that they are interwoven, and we separate them out, much like you described earlier in the show when you say science discounts or ignores certain things in order to learn things. So we discount certain pieces of information in order to separate out various aspects of our reality into dimensions. So my sense is that the connection to the Merkaba is the equivalent of the aspect of us that is fully connected to God. So when we activate the Merkaba through this Flower of Life workshop, we actually become connected to the version of ourselves that's fully aware of God. And it's a bit like getting, T1 or T7 access, I suppose.
I'm reminded of a moment in the New Testament where, and it was probably recreated more graphically than I wanted to see, so I missed the movie. And that was when Jesus was hanging on the cross and the Father had to withdraw from him so that he could bear all the sins on his own, at least according to tradition. But the instant that communication was cut off, he felt it, and that's when he said, "Father, why hast thou forsaken me?" And from that, you gain an assumption that his whole life he had this connection. Even, you know, while he was walking or while he was eating or while he was teaching or learning, he had this connection. And had hit my cough button. For his whole life, we assumed that we could never have that kind of connection, that only he, being ostensibly the only Son of God, could have that. But what the Merkaba has done for me, and I have not been at it as long as Drew, even, or even most people, it has opened this connection, just like you say, like a T1 direct connect, and
yes. It's
on all the time.
Yes, and I feel that your named example is brilliant because people can identify with that. They're familiar with that. They understand it. And when you explain how suddenly in the moment of surrender, Jesus felt that he had been abandoned, that explains it all because that's probably how we all felt when we came in and had to get used to it until we make this connection. And
yeah, we just got used to the quiet or only getting sound through our ears.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, the Merkaba is quite profound. You know, people say to me, well, how is your life different? How is your life better? How, you know, what difference is it going to make in my life? And the first thing I say is, well, the best part is it only takes 5 minutes to do. Once you master it, if you 5 minutes and you're done, and you can get up and walk away at 5 minutes if you want. And the thing that I found it has done for me is it's taken my abilities, my understandings, my capacity to comprehend anything that's around me, and multiplied it 10 or 100 fold so that my ability to interact in the reality with no matter what is going on puts me at a big advantage because I can feel and sense way more than I have a way to justify knowing.
Well, just for those listeners that have not partaken of this, there is a process by which you consciously drop into and over to and inside of your own heart. It's a sacred space in your heart. And for some people, that is extremely easy, almost natural. You just drop down and over and in it, and you're used to the feeling. And then you learn some very dynamic tools that you can do, very dynamic activities that you can do while you're there. For others, and I'm not going to say what the percentage is because I've only gone to one workshop myself, and I want to share a little bit about that later in the program, but, you know, what do you tell the student who grasps this right away, can drop into their heart and make this connection and even consciously go throughout their day and function and be in that spot? What do you advise to them?
Well, the first thing I'll say is congratulations, because it doesn't happen to everybody right away that fast. And so anytime that happens, I'm always excited for them. And secondly, then I invite them to develop a practice. And I teach that if you will take a practice for a six-week period where you deliberately ask dumb, silly, unimportant questions for the next 6 weeks of your inner guru, this higher self energy, and purposefully not ask anything that's important, you will develop the continuity that you're looking for. And it is continuity that will help you through the next thing, because our ego has gotten very good at taking care of us. It got us into the class in the first place. So certainly there's nothing wrong with whatever the ego does or tells us. And the ego is a bit like a really good administrative assistant, and who's not going to give up control of the drama very easily. But if you told your assistant, look, I'm going to start, you know, doing all the restaurant theater reservations, and after a while she might say, well, you know, what's wrong with the way I do it? And you can say, well, you know, I got the Zagat guide, or I got this, and I've gotten access to all this information. She's going to go, well, you know, that's not a bad thing. It's turning out pretty well, and then I don't have to work so hard. And that's exactly what happens during the 6 weeks. The ego is not caring. If you look in your refrigerator and you're looking for a snack, do I have carrots or do I have cookies? You know, if your higher self says go for the cookies, then there's a reason, and you'll discover it after the fact. And you don't always know right away, but that's the beauty of the practice. You have no attachment to the question and what it is you're asking. That's why it's a dumb, stupid, unimportant question.
Wow.
At some point, the ego gets to see some benefit. If you have chicken or pork chops and you're deciding which to fix, maybe you've got pork chops for one and you're eating alone tonight, and you know, you go and ask your higher self, well, which should I fix? And you get told the whole chicken. You go, okay. You cook the chicken and the doorbell rings, and it's some family member that you didn't know was going to be in town, and they stop by and they love chicken. I mean, it's some lovely coincidence like that that shows up. And it doesn't always show up every single time. But with practice, the ego part of us that wants us to be safe, wants us to be happy, gets to observe this connection. And then, you know, that's just the tip of the iceberg, because, of course, the basis of awareness is always built on this. I tell the story when one of my children was quite young, before he was able to say whole words, he was very fond of cheese, but he couldn't say cheese. So every time I gave him cheese, he would say ga, ga, G-A. And so within a very short period of time, he had taught me his word for cheese. So sometimes people don't have that connection. Sometimes people don't get the awareness when we do that heart connection. They just don't feel it. Maybe they're shut down. Maybe they're so linear. I certainly was one of those people. I was just so linear, so theoretical in my thinking that this sensing wasn't there. So I wanted to develop something that people could really get their arms around. So I explain, you know, if your higher self doesn't come in and give you that awareness, then you teach your higher self, this is what I'd like to stand for, this sense of agreement, and this is what I want to stand for, disagreement. And then you practice with that. You know, you try and replicate it. And over the course of time, that gets clarity. And if your higher self wants to come in and give you some other kind of clarity, it will, and you'll get both signals.
One of the
funniest
things that,
stories I have is with a man who came to my class, who came as a courtesy to me because he worked with me and he was interested in the work, but he wasn't really, you know, necessarily somebody who was interested in the spirituality side of it or anything like that. And when we got to this exercise where he connected with his higher self and asked for a signal for yes, his higher self gave him a red beating heart. And when his when we asked his higher self for a signal for no, he got a green M&M.
Wow.
And he came out of the meditation and he said, is it possible for your higher self to have a sense of humor? And the next day, the same man came out of his meditation and said, is it okay if my higher self's a woman?
Hence the green M&Ms.
And the answer is, of course. It's perfect.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter.
Drew asked
no
the question about the Kundalini, and I had someone IM me about out-of-body experiences and astral traveling. And this is, post, I don't know if it's pre or post meditation type of experiences that Drew's talking about, but can we become disconnected or more aware of areas, physical areas or physical times that we are not local to while in this state?
Yes. Not only can you do it while you're in this state, but you can also do it while you're not in this state.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, once you get really good at it, it goes back to the metaphor you made of Jesus, where he was connected all the time, when he was eating, when he was talking to the people. And so if the connection's on all the time, you have full access. So
we have access to the past, the future, the present, and multiple futures?
Yes, but just like a language, if you're a beginner, your vocabulary is quite limited. And as you grow in experience, your capacity to work with the knowledge, just like your capacity to work with a language, increases. So practice improves the understanding, it improves the awareness, it improves the comprehension. I tell people that the practice opens the heart, and the wider your heart is open, the bigger your connection through your heart to your divinity, the greater your capacity to comprehend whatever nonlinear data is coming in.
Well, since we're talking about nonlinear, when mortal mathematicians and philosophers started realizing that sacred geometry and things had these ratios and these relationships like phi with a capital P and phi with a small p and pi. How important are these relationships in creation?
Well, I think that it is vital, but at the same time it's not important. And the reason I say that is because mathematics is still a system whereby we map the reality that we're in. And it is simply a man construct or a human construct. So from that perspective, it doesn't matter because the reality is what we experience and what we feel and what we perceive. But language or mathematics or science provide us with a system of comprehension that allows us then to create and do things in a material way that we are unable to do without that.
Well, right. Now, of course, when mathematicians or biologists think about creation or about multiplication in, say, biological systems or natural systems, there are two ways. There's binary, and then there's this Fibonacci sequence, this progression made by adding the two previous numbers to make the next number in the sequence. And, typically when we teach it to students in beginning algebra, we start with zero and go that way. But in your book, you mentioned a sequence called the Phoenix sequence or the Phoenix effect. How does this apply to this Fibonacci system? And then we're going to go into the importance of why.
Okay. Well, first of all, one of the principal attributes of the Fibonacci sequence, this 1, 1, 2, 3, 5, whereby if you're on 5, you look to 3 and you get 8. If you're on 8, you look to 5 to get 13. So you're taking the previous number and the current number to create the next number. The Phoenix sequence is any pair of numbers added in the same fashion, in logarithmic. So you take any pair of numbers, whether it's, you know, 15 and 86, and you add them the same way. So you would add 15 and the 86, and then the sum of that total you would add to the 86, and then the sum of those two totals to create the next number. And you do that until you've created 10 pairs. And if you will divide the last two of the 10 pairs, you get the same answer that you would get with the Fibonacci sequence. You get this 1.618, this phi number, which is the most irrational number of all the irrational numbers. Now, the reason I use this as a metaphor for creation is because I believe that phi is found in everything. And, you know, one of the most compelling places that phi is used is in the stock market trading. And I have worked with a number of traders, day traders, who use the expression of phi wherever it shows up as a signature to direct how they trade and when they trade. And when they see phi playing out, that's when they, you know, they make their decisions. And these people make very, very good incomes using this mathematical tool. Now, in the case of the manifestation tool, the way I use it is I teach that wherever you are is one of those two core numbers that you would use. And then I ask people to think about where they'd like to be. Then I ask them to go beyond where they'd like to be to some distant point beyond it that proves their heart's desire has occurred. And then those two extremes become the point of vibration which produces phi. And just mathematically, it has to present then that third item, which is the middle piece. It may take a bit, or it may happen very quickly. It's a point of reference that the closer the two numbers are to each other, so if you choose 13 and 18, that will produce phi before you get to the ninth and tenth iteration.
Sure.
But it's not widely known, and I wanted to give it a concept, so that's why it was named the Phoenix Sequence.
Because you kind of have this amazing non-rational ratio rise out of the flames of chaos of two seemingly unrelated numbers.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes, and for the sake of the listeners, I'd like to go into a little bit why this ratio is so important and why we use the concept of a ratio in the first place. And that is to say that when we first learned about the circle and the radius, we know that the common piece between a circle and its radius is pi. PI, 3.14, that practically everybody knows and can rattle off. And so I say to them, think about it. If you have a small circle and a large circle, the relationship always shows up as pi. So pi is a constant that always shows up, even though it's an irrational number. And the reason it's an irrational number is because you cannot predict it. You can only memorize it or do the math. And then we talk about, well, you know, what was the source code? And the source code is 22 over 7. That's what the ancients used to represent pi because they didn't have the decimals. So if you think in your head, okay, 3 into 22, that's 21, and there's, 7 into 22, you get 3 with something left over. So everybody can kind of get their arms around it and go, oh, now I get it. This relationship always shows up, whether it's a little circle or a big circle. And then we show with a tool how that same relationship, a different kind of relationship, also an irrational number, but a constant, shows up in the length of the bones between the little finger and the wrist, and the length of the bones between the length of the wrist and the forearm. And we chart it out so people can get their arms on it, can physically see it and touch it. So then people begin to understand that it was the relationship that the ancients revered, which goes back to the double square, which you are the expert on.
Well, I, you know, mathematically can see all of those effects. I see the circle inside the square like Da Vinci drew, and I see the ratio made of the radius of the circle and that radius folding out to create the next square, which is sort of the next rectangle in that ratio.
So what I believe is that it is the force of change in the universe.
Yes.
The force of change in the universe is found in phi, in that there is always some element that is a surprise, and yet if you go back to the source code, it requires the presence of two numbers in relationship.
Yes, or two magnitudes. And that kind of brings me to my next subject is, you know, a lot of people say, and it's even said in the scriptures, as a man thinketh, so is he. And many other philosophies have a similar idea. In your book, you say, what you think about is what you will manifest, even if your thoughts are subconscious. You do that now. You have your unique viewpoint. No one sees the world quite like you do.
Mm-hmm.
So that makes us each original. It makes us each perfect originals of who we are, whether we are infirm compared to others, brilliant or average or below average compared to others. We are the perfect us, the perfect person. And we may be completely happy with where we are and what we are. I don't know anyone like that, maybe a few. We always have something or some person that we want to be, some skill we want to develop, some fear we want to overcome. So using this system, using this natural form of creation, this almost ratiometric way of putting numbers together and arranging them and looking for the next number, the next important source of energy, how does one consciously think about what they want, and how does this manifestation process occur? I know lots of people now that have been through the Flower of Life workshops, and some that still have the question, how do you then manifest things?
Well, the first thing I want to say is I experience the Merkaba itself as a manifestation field. So with an active Merkaba, we are far more likely to manifest whatever it is we think about. Now, in the Genie class, we actually spend quite a bit of time helping people sort out what it is that they really, really want. One of the earlier manifestations that I did with myself was where I wanted to manifest the tuition money that I needed for my son's college education. And initially, I thought I wanted $5,000 every semester for the next 4 years, which would have been $40,000. And the first semester, I managed to muster up the $5,000, which was way beyond my means. And I remember thinking, I don't want to do that again. That was way too hard. And so one of the first things we ask people to do is think of the biggest version of what it is you really want. So in my case, I didn't want to come up with $5,000 seven more times. I wanted to have my son graduate. And what did that look like? What that looked like was him in a cap and gown. So then the visual becomes not the $40,000, because anybody who's had money problems can tell you the thought of having that amount of money in their checking account just makes them nervous, because they can't even put their arms around it. They feel so, you know, so out of touch with it. It isn't until after you get the hang of it that you can actually put your arms around it. So for me, to think about coming up with $40,000 was almost unthinkable. But I could see him in a cap and gown. And when I got scared about that, I simply looked at a picture of him in his high school cap and gown and then saw him as if it were college and heard myself say, which is part of the drama, part of the creation matrix, you know, there were some scary moments. That's the present. But it wasn't that hard. That's the beyond the present, beyond the heart's desire. The point that said I could look back and say, you know, that wasn't that hard. If I didn't say there was some scary moments, then I would be denying my present.
So what you're talking about is accurately and realistically creating the end vision. Not the vision of getting the $5,000, the vision of your son graduating.
Yes, and, you go to some point beyond what it is. So pick anything that you know of somebody wants to manifest, and I'll give you the example, because it would be fun to play that way.
Yeah, okay. Gosh, I mean, you could almost do it as a game, but...
Okay. Yeah, we could. We could. Maybe someday there will be a game called the manifestation game. But I'll do one that's very common, and that is, you know, you want to be with your beloved. You know, you need your partner, or you want to be with your partner.
Uh-huh.
Well, if you're with the person of your dreams, that might mean you're married or you're happily living together, some version of that. But what happens after that proves that occurred?
Oh, I see. Right, I got you. Like the reward or the,
exactly.
The Emmy or the Grammy or the Oscar.
And how do you reward yourself if you're happily with your beloved and you've been with this person, let's say a year or 2 years, how do you happily celebrate that?
Okay, yeah.
You go out to dinner, maybe you have a glass of wine or you have a special drink and you clink glasses. So you narrow it down to one little thing like clinking glasses, looking at the other person. Now, if you're heterosexual and you're a man, you're going to see a woman. You might not know what the woman looks like, but you know it's a woman. So you're aware of maybe that aspect of it, but it's a faceless face. And you see him or her looking at you back and saying, you know, I am so happy. These are the best years of my life. That produces the central piece, which is that you are with your beloved. So you can take anything that you can name, and you kind of frame it as best you can. You take the most evolved version of that. Then you say, okay, that's history. That's history. That happened 5 years ago. So let's say your book is a bestseller, and you want to see it as a bestseller. What version of the future proves that your book was a bestseller? Maybe you get an award. What kind of an award would it be? And you visualize that outcome that proves that it was a bestseller and it changed history. Do you see?
All right. Now that has to do with future events.
Yes, but what you're doing is you're going to the heart's desire, which is, let's say, I want my book to be a bestseller. Then you go beyond that, looking back, saying, because it became a bestseller, science had to look at it. They could no longer ignore it. And that's when they realized it carried some fabulous piece of information that was overlooked. Because all the well-known breakthrough scientists were renegades. You know, Tesla was a renegade. Einstein was a renegade. The man who created fractals, Mandelbrot, was a renegade. He was thrown out of the French Mathematical Society. He never even finished his degree with them. And these are the people who get around the frontiers because they're not limited in their thinking.
So this vision, is you can consider it an observation that you are actually observing.
Exactly. I tell people they need three elements that represent three of the dimensions. The two, the linear, the 2D dimension, is looking back in time, because looking back in time is linear. Looking forward in time is not. Looking forward in time, you can see multiple possibilities. But when you look back in time, you only see the history, which is linear. That's 2D. 3D is you must have a real-time conversation with someone. That means you imagine somebody that you would be with having this conversation that marks the celebration. So if it's about the book that you've sold and won an award, then the conversation is with somebody who would be important to you, your beloved, your book agent, somebody. And you would clink glasses and you would hear them say, congratulations, I always believed in you. And you would say, thank you. You'd hear it. You'd know it. And it wouldn't even have to be somebody you know today, but it would be somebody you know you would know. And that's 3D. And then 4D is the emotion. Well, if you heard someone who believed in you, whether it's your book agent or your beloved or your mom, whoever it would be, if you heard them say, "I always knew you were going to do it," and you would hear that in their voice, in their style of thinking, you would suddenly feel this huge emotion that would be a real-time response. Now, there's all kinds of studies about athletes who practice and then add half an hour of practice, and then they compare that to the same athletes who spend a half an hour visualizing the practice, and the increase in their performance is 25% with real-time practice and 24% with a visualization of the practice. So there's thousands of studies that support that the mind cannot tell the difference between a visualized experience and a real one. Now, just to digress for a little bit, I want to tell a story about one of the classes that I taught years ago. A big group of people, over 100 people in the room, this man stood up and he said, "I want to be the marketing director for the Miami Dolphins." And I said, "Okay, who are you going to tell this to once you have the job? You know, now that you have the job, you're going to call somebody?" And he said, "Yeah, I'd call my mom." And I said, "Well, let's role play. You ready?" And he said, "Sure." And I said, "Okay, let's pretend, you know, ring, 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 the phone's ringing," and I answer, and I say, "Hi, son, how you doing?" And he stopped. He said, "I can't go any further." And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Well, you're recording it." And because I was so intuitive, I'm always so intuitive in these environments, I looked at him and I said, "Okay, clean up your language and say it anyway." And he said, "Okay, Mom, I'm working for the effing Dolphins." And I said, "Okay, that's great. What did your mom say back?" "No effing way." And everybody in the room is in an uproar. And I said to him, "Does your mother talk that way?" And he said, "Yes." And I said, "Then that's the visual for you." He could feel it. He could sense it. It was real.
Well, if she doesn't talk that way, she would if she found out he was working for the Dolphins. Well, I was going to ask you some questions, because back in the 2D part where we were looking at the past and looking at the future, in physics we have an effect, and I'm sure we'll talk about it more tonight, and that's the observation effect.
The collapse model.
Yeah, I mean, we have sophisticated instruments with which we look at subatomic or atomic processes, whether they're spectrographic or, and there's numerous different ways of doing that, X-ray fluorescence spectroscopy, laser spectroscopy, we bombard it with electrons in a microscope, but even though we get a nice picture back, the people that read or see that in, say, Scientific American or Popular Mechanics, they don't think about the effect that the laser or the electrons or the X-ray had on the sample itself. They only see the result of that picture. Well, one of the instruments that we have at our disposal is us, our human mind, our consciousness. If we go back and we look at the past with this kind of intention, with this kind of manifesting power, I mean, we're looking at it, we're not replaying it, we're going back to examine things. Do we not have an observation effect on our past?
Well, certainly, and that's the joke is, in my opinion, that we're actually traveling back in time to a parallel version of it, because we really don't have access to the one that occurred because it's linear to us. So if we're going back to a possible choice, we've already changed the system, that we're no longer going back in a linear fashion. We're going back in an almost linear to a parallel reality, which then could be different and could cause us to have a new experience.
Well, then if we have a new experience in the past, are we not creating a new future?
Indeed.
Which is the present.
That's true. And I believe it is possible to change the past. And I have experienced some crazy things that would maybe imply that I've changed the past.
Well, would you be surprised to know that there is clinical evidence that the past can be altered?
I love it. I want to know more.
I read a really strange book called... I think it was Psychology, the Misunderstood Science. And in this book, he talked about a lot of clinical evidence that had been collected during the 40s and 50s, largely funded by the government, and blind and double-blind studies, lots and lots and lots of data. Some of it never acted upon, but this guy went back and accessed a lot of the data. And a couple of the experiments were very, very well done and very well controlled. And as it turns out, there were certain individuals who surfaced in their search for talent, shall we say, who had a remarkable ability to psychokinetically alter the performance of number generators, let's say.
Yes, I've heard of these studies.
And they would run the experiment like 2 years before and collected all this data, and it was in a safe in a vault. And then they brought this guy in, and they had him go back to that event and try to alter the number generator 2 years in the past. And darned if the data didn't change, even though it was on a hard record stored in a vault. It was pretty interesting.
That's fabulous.
Yeah, and of course you think, holy cow, you know, this really opens a lot of parameters. So
yes, that means I can go back and undo the brownies I ate at lunch.
Well, I believe, and I write this in my stuff, is that everything we do will eventually affect the universe. And then later I added to it. I actually wrote that when I was in college, and then I wrote a couple of years ago, try to do it on purpose. You know, it's sort of like, you know.
Yes, well, I guess that would, you know what, that's a good definition of manifestation. Everything we do alters the universe. Now, if you can do it on purpose, then you're manifesting.
Right, but a lot of people say, well, what's done is done. You know, it's done, it's in the past, don't think about it. But actually, if you go back, and not dwell on it, but actually go back and maybe change the way you reacted during an argument, or change the way you paid attention in physics class. And when you do that, you begin to change the present. You change who you are. You
Yes.
begin to grow. You don't learn that lesson the same way you learned it last time. You go back and you remember things that you missed on the test. And this time, if you took that test, you'd get it right. And the other is this: when you're in the heart, I have found, at least personally, and I'm not even a novice at this, I've been doing it about 3 months, I find that not my perspective, but my input from the timeline changes. It no longer is just a little tiny one-dimensional spot. It is kind of turned into a headlight on the highway. And I'm in the middle of the splash of light on the road. I see a little bit of the past, and I see quite a bit of the future, and it's not a linear line. It is more like a fog of all possibilities. And it seems as if once I choose a path, then the fog goes a little bit further out. It's sort of like all the other possibilities have now been eliminated, and there's one thin line in the road. And up until the point where I've made my choice in that future, then the fog begins again. And this
yes.
You kind of address this in your book, and you call it the collapse theory. So
let's talk about it
from your perspective, and then we'll add a little bit of physics to it.
There's a wonderful movie called Mr. Destiny with James Belushi that is a marvelous, marvelous study of this, where he goes into a bar and laments something that happened to him when he was in high school. And he's having this drink with this man, and suddenly everything is different.
Michael Caine.
Yes.
Michael Caine. I remember that movie. Go ahead.
It's such a favorite because it really helps you get your arms around the possibility of change and possibility of something being different. And once you go back, as you have already stated, it is always never the same after that. So I tend to agree with you, but I also believe that there's only merit in doing that if there's something specific we wanted to fix or we wanted to change.
Yeah.
Because it's really all about expanding the database anyway. So if everything else pleased us, you know, it's simply a way to experience the reality in a new way, and to know that we have the freedom to do it is marvelous. It's very exciting to recognize these
things. Well, how does our observation collapse the possibility?
Well, according to what I understand about the collapse theory, it is the idea that all possibilities exist at the same time. And then when a person makes an observation, they actually change the reality, and that everything collapses into that one version. Now, when I try to experience it for myself, my experience is slightly different than that. And I believe that, that there aren't infinite possibilities, but there are multiple possibilities. And that the multiples are big enough that it feels like it's almost infinite. But for example, as a skater, you know, you might imagine yourself doing a certain thing. That's a natural multiple, could be multiple versions of that. But if you weren't a skater, you might not imagine yourself as a skater, unless it's something you really wanted to do. So in the world of possibilities, all possibilities exist that are somehow related to the present moment, either in idea or thought or likelihood like that. And that when we put our thought on a particular version, a particular thread that takes us to a particular path, that the others cease to be funded with our energy, with our thought, with the reality around us. And it is the localizing of our thought that focuses the energy on that particular path that creates what is called the collapse model. But I've never heard it explained by a physicist this way. It's simply my experience.
Well, yeah, it kind of reared its head, I guess, 1800s, when Max Planck's theory of wave-particle duality was tested for the first time with what's called the multiple slit experiment.
Mm-hmm.
When a particle, a photon, was aimed at a slit, it formed an interference pattern on the film as though it was a wave. And that was quite interesting to them. They didn't understand that, so they decided to see if they could measure the spin on the photon before it went through the slit. And, of course, as soon as they did that, they only got one line. The interference lines went away. So what appeared to happen is that the photon behaved like a particle when it was observed, and when not observed, it appears like a wave.
Mm-hmm.
So the other data disappeared. The other lines of future, the other lines or paths that photon could travel on disappeared as soon as the path was chosen. And that's the physics way of looking at it. It's sort of like saying, all right, you're standing in a point in space. And it may be one of those really important places, like you're getting ready to make a job decision or who to marry or whether or not to quit your job or do something major. So you're standing at a point where there's thousands of light beams going away from the single point that you're at in space. You're going to choose one of them. You can only choose one. And as soon as you choose, that juxtaposition where you're standing disappears, and you're on a single light beam until you get to the next decision point. So that's kind of the collapse theory. There's no going back to that one spot and picking another, like backing up several steps in an electronic chess game. Oops, it beat me that time. Let me back up to the point where it took my knight and try it again. You don't get that chance in life. So how do we manifest? Once we manifest our vision, this vision comes to us and we apply this energy. We'll talk about that a lot in the next hour, this fourth dimensional energy that we can apply. Once we make that decision, then all other choices, all other futures become impossible.
Was that a question or statement?
Well, I made the statement, and now I'm trying to figure out a question.
Is not that. I believe that there could be multiple versions of me doing all the versions that I could think of to do that one thing.
Well, I want to be the fun one.
Well, as I joke around, I want to be the one that gets published first of all the versions of me out there. And it's kind of my joke when I tell people, what motivates me? I want to be the one that got out of bed this morning and got to the whatever, made it to the finish line.
Yeah, I don't want to be the one that's stuck in scarcity. I want to.
Well, there's a version of you that is, and that one didn't. That one's not nearly as well funded as the version of you that we're talking with.
But that one loves me and has assumed that position of exclusive existence to keep me out of it.
There
so
you go.
I can be here.
I love it.
So let's say you collapse something, that you observed it collapsed, but it wasn't something you didn't want to collapse. Can you recover that original and bring it back online?
Very likely, but not right away. Because and the more you rue about it, the less likely it is possible. That, you know, if you were to try to go back in time energetically and change something, you would do it where there's the least amount of support energetically for that to have occurred. So if you, you know, yelled at someone and then punched them in the nose, and, you know, they sued you and there was all this energy around it, it'd be more difficult to undo than if you just yelled at them and walked away, because there's less energy on it. And so one of the ways that you mitigate anything that you do is to put less importance on it, less attachment, less awareness, and it becomes less of a central figure to whatever else is going on. And then changing the present may be a matter of changing other forces that will give you the same result.
I see. And if it was not something, you know, like getting a C in a class instead of an A, I guess you could go back and take the class over again, but then all the events that were planned after you got the A in that class would have to be delayed another semester. If it was something just emotional, that you made a choice to distance yourself from a certain person because they made you feel indifferent or something, and then you realize later, oh, gee, that person really does love me. I wish I could start that relationship over. I wish I could take that back. I guess the answer is, you can go get that back, but it's probably
right.
going to take a little bit of crow eating.
Right, especially if you were the only one having the ill will, the low feelings.
Right.
Yeah, because you could change yours, because you have total control over your immediate area. And this is something else that I teach in the Genie system, is this awareness that we have spheres of influence around us, our personal sphere of influence, our family, our culture, the society, the mass consciousness, and all of those things impact us and are pushing in on us. And so the more personal integrity we have, the more control we have over what happens in our personal sphere.
Sure, yeah. I mean, earlier I said there are those people that feel acted upon by the universe and those that act upon the universe, but there are all kinds of forces acting upon you from individuals, from family, from community, and even from country, and even from planet. And then universal consciousness, even non-human consciousness that is influencing us.
All true.
In your book, and I actually had this happen, so I underlined it, it said you can usually tell when you are in that place, a smile breaks out all over you, your shoulders may drop, and you feel warm and fuzzy.
Mm.
It feels good, and you resonate with the outcome.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've actually had that happen, and in fact, more often of late than before in my
That's
life.
That's really exciting, because that once you feel that pattern, and we'll call that an interference pattern, that allows you to replicate, to know you're manifesting right then you can replicate it again. You know, it's like once you learn how to balance yourself on a bike, you can do it again and again and again, and so the more you have it, the more you get it. The more you get it, the more you have it. And what's really awesome is when you're in a class and someone is doing one of these manifestations out loud for everyone to observe and learn from, they get to that place where they get that warm fuzzy. Everybody in the room can feel it.
Wow. Well,
that's amazing.
It's a good indication that you're on the right path.
Yes, yes. And I feel very blessed to be able to have this fun. You know,
well, I, for one, am glad that there are 101 facilitators. And she's here on our program tonight. Her name is Maureen St. Germain, and she wrote a great book called You Are the Genie in the Bottle. One more time, tell us how to get that book, and then we'll take our second break.
You can go to the website, which is called Angel Angel, A-N-G-E, A-N-G-L-E-A-N-G-E-L, because I'm all about angles and angels. Or you can use my name, MaureenSaintGermain.com.
Wonderful. Excellent. I'm having a great time. Can't believe 2 hours are gone already.
It's gone very fast.
All right. Well, this is X Squared Radio. My name is Brooks Agnew, and we'll be back in about 6 minutes for our final hour. Shuttle fleet is very soon going to be retired. No other spacecraft in history has advanced the world more than this fleet. I wanted a way to keep that memory alive in my home, so I went to the space store and ordered a 25-inch model of the Space Orbiter. People who have seen it always comment on the incredible attention to detail in this model. If you know someone who loves the space program, and you want to get them a gift that they will never forget, you should visit the Space Store at X Squared Radio. People are always looking for something inexpensive and unique to give people they love. Well, now there is a way to give a gift that not only says how long you will love them, but it also allows you to help keep the planet green and growing. Tree Givers at X Squared Radio is the company that will plant a tree on public land somewhere in the 50 states and provide your special person with a beautiful certificate of that placement. This has become one of the most popular gift sites in the world. And because of their love for the earth, they are changing the world. So visit Tree Givers at X Squared Radio and see if you can find a gift for your special person. Brooks Agnew here with X Squared Radio. If you like wildlife art and would love to add some of the most beautiful replicas to your home or office, you should visit Wildlife Gifts at X Squared Radio. They have everything from pandas to fish to eagles to horses in all sizes and price ranges. No matter what animal you love, they have the art for you. So visit Wildlife Gifts at X Squared Radio for that special someone today. You know, we have revealed to you the ancient predictions that natural disasters are going to increase in power and frequency in these times. We might not always have the National Weather Service or the Emergency Broadcasting Service. So you might want to get your hands on some of the best weather reporting instruments around. Visit Wind and Weather at X Squared Radio and pick up something that might be useful. They also have the neatest gift for your favorite people who like things for the outdoors or for their meditation garden. Check out Wind and Weather at X Squared Radio. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio with a message for our friends in the radio broadcast world. If you have noticed that your listeners aren't around anymore, it's because they are right here with us. If you would like them back in your radio fold, then all you have to do is add X Squared Radio to your program content. Statistics don't lie. We are now the fastest growing talk radio program in North America. Don't be late, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio. welcome back, my friend, to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. In here, the results are always positive. You are aware that we are entering into an age of power in our world. Space is opening up to more and more countries. Technology has been racing around the world, free and available to all the bright young minds for about 10 years now with the Internet. Technology levels are doubling about every 7 years or so. At this rate, we are coming to the edge of a global metamorphosis. You feel it, and I believe that all life is in the universe can feel it as well. If you want to know what's going on and how to get positioned for what is about to happen, you need to stay here on X Squared Radio. Yes, we are growing so fast I can scarcely keep up with the program. Running the board and keeping up with questions and reading books and interviewing guests, that's the fun part. But then there are the parts where we're continually finding new guests and keeping up with technology and trying to reach all of you. So we're growing again. Tell your friends that right here on this program is where they will hear the latest improvements in energy and human consciousness, because we are Earth explorers here, and if you are one, then you are welcome here. We'll get the guests, and you can bring your imagination. You're going to need it. What we're about to reveal to you is going to change everything your mama taught you. My guest tonight is Maureen St. Germain. Wonderful guest. Her book is You Are the Genie in the Bottle. And you can go to her website, which is angleangel.com, because she's all about angles. And now we are going to talk a little bit about angels. We've talked about higher selves and being in the heart. If you're not familiar with those terms, then perhaps you should go to, is it floweroflife.com?
Flowerlife.org.
Oh, flowerlife.org. And sign up for a workshop. There are at least 101 facilitators out there. And learn how to take this most practical form of meditation. She mentioned earlier in the program that it takes about 5 minutes. I believe it is 17 breaths, however long it takes you to get through that. It's sort of an individual thing. There are some meditation CDs, which Maureen has been instrumental in producing, that will help you stay on timing and kind of get into that zone. But I'll tell you, I've been doing transcendental meditation since I was about 18 years old. And this is a very practical method of meditation, very powerful. It brings to bear the personal manipulation of sacred geometry in not just an imaginary form, in a real form. And it allows you to tap into energy. It allows you to tap into your own intention and provide it a theater in which it can operate and help you in your life more than you can imagine. And I know your imaginations are big. That's because I know that because you're here at X Squared Radio. But since we are talking about theaters, one of the things that Maureen brings out so well in her book, because I was really looking for some nuts and bolts in this book, she talks about making your own movie as a method of manifestation. I think this is so profound. And without giving away everything that's in the book, because we want you to buy the book, trust me, it's well worth the read. Plenty of margins and space between paragraphs to make notes, and I make them copiously. Tell us about how to make this movie. How do we manifest our dreams?
Well, first of all, whenever you make, if you think about making a movie, it means that you have the ability to choose the director, you can write the screenplay, you have control over all the elements. The first concept that goes back to one of the original questions you asked me in the first hour, and that's about choice. And so we empower an individual, we empower you as a listener, to decide that you have choice here and you can choose whatever you want. And you go from there. the movie itself is a concept in that you create a movie in your mind. And in a movie, you see things happen. You see action. You don't see stills. So the action is conceptually you looking back in time after you've achieved your heart's desire. Now, one of the reasons why we don't just focus on the goal of what it is you want, let's say you're a runner and you want to win a particular race, you want to have a certain time in your race, you don't just look at that as the outcome, because what I have found is that people go to that idea or that concept, and because they can't really visualize it, they think they're visualizing it, they think they're thinking about it, but in fact they're actually at the edge of it. I call it the wall. And they don't give themselves permission to have it. And the proof is when we do it where we go to a point in the future beyond the heart's desire, beyond the goal that you've had, that you've named, if you can't imagine what would happen as you look backward at having had it and having achieved it, it's a clear sign that there's some part of you that won't let you have it. In one class, I had a woman who wanted to have this fabulous bar mitzvah for her son, and it was 2 years away, and she was already thinking about it and already worried about it. She went to a different synagogue than her husband did, and she didn't feel very comfortable with the people that she worshipped with, and she didn't feel like she belonged. She felt like she was maybe an interloper, and so she was very uncomfortable, and this was really important to her, to give her son a fabulous party. So I said to her, well, do you know of any time where you've had a really good party that went well? Cannot think of a one. Well, what about this? What about this? And I, you know, posed various questions of the likely scenarios. You know, what about when your son was born? What, you know, did you have a christening? No. So we were all the way back in time, in her memory, to her wedding. So was the wedding perfect? Yes. Was the food good? Oh, it was fabulous. What about the band? Oh, the band was wonderful. Did you have a good attendance? Oh, my gosh, everybody came. What did people say afterwards? Oh, they raved about it. Okay, this is the perfect scenario. So then we allowed her to think about the wedding again, you know, and we encouraged her to really, in her mind, relish what that event was. Now go to the day after the wedding. How did that feel? How did you feel knowing everything went perfectly and all that work paid off? Felt awesome. Okay, instantly, it's the day after the bar mitzvah. Everything went as planned. People showed up. The food, the band, everything was perfect.
Wow. So it wasn't actually the bar mitzvah that she visualized. It was the after effect.
Yes. You always visualize the after event, is what I call it, the after event. If your event is the bar mitzvah, then you have to go to something after it to prove that it occurred.
I see.
Because otherwise you go to this wall that's in your head that you don't even see. So you're like a little kid looking at a big castle. You don't really own it. And in her case, there was no way she could own it because she felt so inadequate. You know, she was new in town. She didn't feel comfortable. So in order for her to own it, we allowed her to go into something else that was familiar. I call it replicating from favorable states. She went to a favorable state in her mind the day after the wedding, and then she dropped in a new movie that said to her, now it's the day after the bar mitzvah, and, you know, it was familiar at that point, and she could then manifest.
And then you asked a very important question to her, and I think I want to explore that a little bit. You said, how do you feel the day after this, the emotion that goes with it? What is this fourth dimensional component? How do we energize that vision with our emotion?
Well, I have found when people allow themselves to have something, when they really let go and imagine that it has already occurred, then they can feel it. So many times there are fears and actions in our mind that undo our manifestations. You know, we can do a manifestation movie in our mind like we've described, and then 2 minutes later we make some stupid little joke about how inadequate we are. We've just undone our little manifestation. Then we go and do the manifestation again, and then we go and think in our head, oh, I'll never get there. And that undoes. So it isn't that we're not creating, it's that we're creating and not creating, creating and not creating. I tell the joke, if you were in a restaurant and every time the waiter walked by to the kitchen, you grabbed him and said, you know what, I changed my mind. I want what that person said. And then, you know, the next time he walked by, oh, I changed my mind. Pretty soon he wouldn't even tell the cook. He'd just wait till he figured you were done making changes.
Yep, I see that. I see that. So, oh, gosh. So this emotion that people can put behind.
Yes, the emotions are coming out of the experience. That's why we call it a movie of the mind. You must let yourself have the opportunity to be in the experience. And it's much more difficult to experience emotion if you're only looking at it as if it might happen.
Right.
When you look at it as if it has already happened, your emotion comes up in an instant. And it happens without you doing anything emotionally. It happens because your thought led you to the place that allowed your mind, your mental process, to believe that it had already occurred. And that belief triggers the spontaneous reaction of emotion, which is your energy magnetized with your feeling, which produces a physical reaction in your body, which you described, you know, where your shoulders drop, the smile breaks out, you feel this great place. There's lots of ways people feel emotion. People feel it the way we've described it. Sometimes they feel a really rosy, wonderful, warm feeling in the center, which is usually the heart opening, which is also a very powerful emotion. Some people have the ability to drop into bliss at the drop of a hat. Some people can allow themselves to think of any wonderful thing. One of the easiest ways that in America that we can teach people to go into an emotional state that is productive and supportive, and I say that there are three, love, joy, and bliss, and that is if you would allow yourself to remember a time that you've held a pet, whether it's a horse and you've had your arms around the neck of the horse, or whether it's a kitty or a dog or any pet, there is this automatic response that we have that allows us to love this little being unconditionally, because whatever the pet does, it doesn't have control like we humans do. You know, if you fall in love with someone, you have expectation they'll love you back a certain way. But, you know, the cat, they sometimes show up when you want and sometimes they don't. But when they're there for you, they're so loving. So it triggers in us this emotional response. So an easy way to get yourself in an emotional state is to just imagine putting your arms around some beloved little pet and then hearing yourself say, I love you, to this pet. That instantly triggers a powerful feeling of unconditional love. And then you make this move. You run the movie that you've already written in your mind at that moment. And that makes the movie come alive because you've tapped into your ability to be in that emotional state at that point.
Well, now, I know some people who have been running this kind of 3D process of visualizing things done and then setting about doing it and using the finishing emotion as a driving force to get them there. And I don't know if they understand that they're actually aligning other forces, resonating other forces with that person while they're making that emotional plea to the cosmos.
Are you talking about involving a third person or a second person?
Yeah, I'm not talking about involving another person. I'm saying that when they make this 3D movie and then they apply their emotion, they're actually sending out, as it were, a karma signal. And that is aligning with other people's energies. It sort of brings them into resonance. It makes them vibrate at the same frequency. And they're asking me, how would the Merkaba meditation facilitate them, assuming that they've never taken the Merkaba? How would the Merkaba meditation take them to the next level and give them some kind of toolbox that they could use that 3D process better?
What the Merkaba does is double or more, just double the squaring, keeps coming back, the capacity to do everything. So what happens is we become more attuned and in tune with everything that we're putting out there. I can remember when I was working as a fundraiser and I needed to contact a particular writer at the newspaper. And everybody said he was impossible to reach, and, you know, good luck. You'll never get him. You'll never get a story out of him. And I visualized the story, and I put it out there. And it, at a precise moment, I picked up the phone and called this man and got him on the phone. And later somebody said, how did you get him? Nobody gets him on the phone. And I said, you know, I didn't tell them about the Merkaba, but, you know, my clear intention was that I would make the connection. And he liked what we had to say. He was excited about what I had to tell him. And he put it on the front page. It was the same day that the Pope was in town. It was like, you look at this and you think to yourself, how did she pull it off? And honestly, it's the synchronicity. It's the willingness to go into that place of allowing the universe to surprise you with the way it fulfills your heart's desire. Because I maintain it is not your job to figure out how. Your job is to figure out what, and the universe will surprise you with the way it comes together. It doesn't mean you sit on your hands. It doesn't mean you don't do your work. It does mean that when you say to the universe, I need an extra $100, and then someone says, okay, if you will go paint this room for me, I'll give you $100, you think, great, now I know how I'm going to get my $100, and, you know, you end up not being able to paint the room, or you paint the room and they don't pay you, but somebody else comes along and says, you know what, I have an extra $100 here, and I know you've been wanting to do this such and such, so here, take it and consider it a gift. And even though you visualized that you would be able to do this special thing with that $100 and you thought you knew how it was going to come together, it doesn't always happen the way you think. And if you allow the universe to surprise you, then what happens is always the easiest, fastest way to achieve it. Now, the Merkaba allows you to align with that kind of energy, that productive, fruitful energy that gives you that alignment sooner, faster, better, easier.
Do you offer a class that a parent could take, say, a late teenage or maybe early 20-year-old child to?
Actually, the youngest people I've had in my class were 15, and it was just an absolute riot. A mother in New York City called me and said, you know, my son wants to take your class. I told him there's no way he can take the class. You know, we live in New Jersey. I'm not driving him into Manhattan to take the class. And all he said to me was that he accepted my no, but he asked if I would please call you. And I said to him, you know, I totally understand. If I were in your shoes, I would have done the same thing. You know, I have four sons. I would be, you know, raising a fuss if one of them said they wanted to do that. And she said, well, do you think it would help him in his, you know, way of living and his expression in high school and stuff? And I said, absolutely. If somebody at his age was willing to take the class, I absolutely guarantee it would improve his life.
Cool.
And his folks loved what it did for him so much that they fully supported him going through all the classes I teach over the course of the next 2 years.
Wow. Well, I don't usually bring myself on the program, hence the acronym X Squared Radio, where the results are always positive. The only number you can put in X Squared to get a negative number is I, so I try to leave I out of it. But I had to bring this up because you're talking about resonation and about the mystical $1,100 showing up and surprising you.
Mm.
I went to the Merkaba training in Washington, D.C., and I met, many wonderful people, but one person that I met, her name is Heidi, and she knew that I was putting together the expedition to go to the North Pole, and she also knew that I still needed a producer. So she said, well, I know somebody here in D.C. He's the videographer for Zachariah Sitchin. And I thought, well, there's no way to schedule it. It's already Thursday. You know, we're going to be out of class and on and back to our hometowns. And she said, no, I'll give him a call. So she gave him a call, and he agreed to meet with us that very same day. So we drove over to D.C., go to his office, walk in, and we're kind of cashing out in the break room of his office. And I'm briefly, almost unrehearsedly telling him about the expedition and how we're putting all these things together and how we've come up with this little pitch video on DVD, and would he please watch it? And he said, sure. So he finished his salad, and we went in, and he watched the pitch video, and he was I think, a little more than mildly impressed with it, at least the production quality of it and the idea of it. It would make a great documentary. He said, "You mind if I burn a copy?" I said, "No, no problem." So he burns a copy, and the next day he takes off for L.A. I expect to never hear from him again. And yet I'm still manifesting that this expedition is actually going to take place, and I've actually felt the cold sea spray in my face while I'm on the boat, just to give you an idea how 3D this manifestation is. So anyway, I get an email the next day from him. He flies to L.A. The limo picks him up at the airport, but instead of taking him to a hotel, takes him to the train station, which surprises him. And the limo driver says, "Well, your accommodations have been changed to the Tequila Express. You're taking the overnight train to Mexico with the production crew." He says, "Oh, no problem." So he throws his bags in a cab and changes into something more comfortable, goes to the dining car, and the leader of their production group, who is also heading up the financing, the producer usually does, and they have a very sizable budget. I mean, way more than I expected. So anyway, he stands up, taps his glass, and he says, "Before we get started, I want to let you know that last night I had the strangest dream that I traveled to the center of the earth."
Oh.
And Jim literally just stands up, spews his drink, and says, "You have to be kidding me. I met with this guy last night on a lark in Washington, D.C. He's planning this expedition. Here's his video. Please watch it." And at the bottom of the email, he says, "Do you have an entertainment attorney?" And I said, "Yes," and I gave him the name and phone number of our attorney in Hollywood. So that's how it's worked out up to this point. And I'm going to have to email you what happens tomorrow when I go back to the office.
Excited. Okay, so we're all going to hear you announce at some point in the future that it all worked out fabulously, even better than you had thought.
Well, yeah,
that's
I kind
after
of
event that
yeah
allows all possibilities.
The after event is me and my friends are my friends and I are sitting around watching the Discovery Channel special on TV.
I like it.
So that's besides you
now,
know
if
being,
you were to do this, let's play with this a minute. If you were to do this, it's not just you and your friends sitting around watching the Discovery Channel. You're going to have a 3D real-time conversation with some person. And you need to, I'm not going to put you on the spot and ask who it is, but imagine in your mind who it is. There is somebody very specific that you would select, and think about that person. And then hear what they say to you. Do you speak first or do they? And what do they say? And hear their words in your head.
Let me put it this way. Behind every successful man
is
an astonished mother-in-law.
Oh, that's fabulous.
So I see, you know, I never thought she would make it on Discovery Channel.
There you go.
Talk.
And you're grinning from ear to ear, and then she says something that would be typical of her. Either, "I'm proud of you," or "You amaze me," or "No effing way," or whatever she would say.
Have another piece of pie. And one other thing that was really strange about this, I didn't notice it going in, but when I walked out of Jim's office onto the streets there in D.C., I looked to the left, and what did I see but the Discovery Channel's home office building?
That's a synchronicity, and that's, you know, one of the things that I talk about near the end of the book is the divinity test. And we haven't really talked about that. It might be a good time to do that.
Yeah, let's do that.
And the divinity test is a name that I've given to this place where all support has been taken away by choice, you know, let go. And it's God asking you, "So, do you believe in you as much as I do?" Much like that moment on the cross for Jesus. And the divinity test is this crazy time where you believe your dream has been taken from you. And sometimes there's one divinity test, sometimes there's a dozen. But there are special moments when these occur, and the way to know that you are absolutely positively where you're supposed to be is a magical moment like you just described, where you looked up and you saw the Discovery Channel, and it was so synchronistic with the timing, with what was going on in the moment, that it was the universe saying, "Attaboy, you're on the right track, you're going to have your outcome, And if there's any incoming feedback that implies you are not, it's simply a mistake, and you deliberately choose to ignore it.
Wow.
So let's say something weird happens, and you know the plug gets pulled somehow, some way, on it, whatever. Some weird thing happens. Even if it does, you still go to that outcome of that movie in your mind. You dismiss the feedback. And just like the scientist who dismisses feedback that doesn't fit the mode, it's a precise action by choice that says, you know what, that's a possibility, but I'm choosing a future that doesn't include that one.
Wow.
You don't say it's not true. You don't say I don't buy it. You simply say I'm choosing another.
Right, right. So if you get a negative feedback or a positive feedback that seems to push you off the course of
exactly.
what you have visualized.
Exactly.
Then you say, well, that's an input. I'm considering it, but I'm not changing course.
Right. It's an input that could occur, but I choose another.
Yeah.
Because, again, you're not denying it. Because when you deny it, you go into resistance. When you wail about it, you go into resistance. So, you know, I tell people, any big disappointments that appear to take us away from our big dream, you know, like everybody watches the show that's, you know, the opportunity to make it big as a singer and to prove yourself.
American Idol.
Yes. And some people don't get their dream, but they still might become a big star, just not on that route.
Well, they probably manifested themselves getting on American Idol, which they did.
Mm.
But they had the wrong after event.
Or no after event at all. Maybe
yeah,
that was it.
Their friends saying, I can't believe you got on American Idol. You sing like crap, but you got on there.
Yes.
Oh, that's funny. So the
divinity test is often accompanied, always accompanied by synchronicity. So whenever the chips are down, if we will just look around us for signs that tell us we are on the right track and we are not chasing windmills like Man of La Mancha, then we know we should pursue it. There will be times that we have these crazy things that we think we should pursue or we would like to pursue, and it isn't in our best interest. And those are the Man of La Mancha dreams we're chasing windmills. And the way to know the difference is the synchronicity. If the synchronicity shows up, we are absolutely on target, even if the outer appearance is not that. So many times we get feedback that says something isn't going to work the way we thought. And we go right into our big disappointment. And if we would allow ourselves to say, you know what, that's obviously not the way I'm going to get what I thought I was going to get, but it doesn't mean I'm not going to get what I want. It just means that's not the road we're taking. We're taking a different way.
So even if you're told you can't be a Flower of Life facilitator because they're not training anymore, you say, I'm taking a different path, and there will be another one, and it will be me.
Yeah, but rather than do it that way, I would say, I'm going to be a facilitator, and I don't care how it happens. I don't care when. And one of the ways that I chose to support that belief for myself was when the workshop came around a second time, I took it because I knew it was required. If they ever did another facilitator training, I was telling the universe, I'm taking my prerequisite now. I don't know if they'll offer it again, but I'm willing to do my part and show up at this prerequisite because I know it's required, and if it never happens, I will have at least done my part. So in that case, it was an opportunity for me to take a divinity test early, so to speak.
Well, I know in going to your website to do some research on you to select you for this program, and by the way, my listeners are the ones that advise that I talk to Maureen St. Germain, and they are never wrong, so I always follow what they say. Thank you, listeners. I noticed that you're booked out way up into October of this year, so that's the kind of life security that just about all my friends want to see. I'm an engineer by by career, a scientist by training. And our lives are not very stable. We work jobs for about 2, 3, maybe 4 years, depends on how long a contract or a program lasts, so it's a rather nomadic lifestyle. But in the last 2 years, since doing this radio program, writing a couple of books, going to all these training workshops and speaking at these conventions, I have discovered what I really want to do. And I'm pursuing it. I'm going after it. And I wanted to ask you about limitations. What is a person's source? How do they reach out there for input?
Well, you go back. I can go back to that list of 500 things. That's a good place to start. And
right.
And then if you do the Merkaba, it puts you in a place of connection with your authentic self, and that in itself is a map for what your version of the reality is, how you're choosing to experience the reality. You know, some people come in to experience information about relationships. Other people come in to experience information about sound or sight. Some people come in to experience, you know, any number of things, and they experience all the variety of it in lots of different ways. So, you know, as when I first pursued my own career, because I was in the corporate world and I had a family, I had obligations, I had responsibilities, I had no desire to go out and do this kind of work as a form of employment, as a way to make a living,
yeah.
Because I felt, you know, there was security in a corporate job, and this was my passion. And, you know, if it's your passion, you don't want to have to make a living at it for fear that you won't get to do it or you'll fail or whatever. And it came about really quite by accident for me, because my passion kept growing and growing. And one day I remember thinking after meditation, you know, I think I'm ready. You know, if I had to do this full time, I think I could do it. You know, and within 3 or 4 weeks, I was offered a buyout opportunity and I took it, you know. And I remember thinking, oh my God, I don't have a real job, and and discovering, well, okay, now what would prove that I have a real job? And the answer was that you're booked solid for a year. So that became one of my early manifestations, that I would have a full schedule. And that very first year that I was out there on my own, I went to a different city every single weekend from January till July 1st, with the exception of Mother's Day and Easter weekend. So in that time frame, I taught the maximum number of workshops, because I felt at the time my sense of you know, like you say, safety or that net, you know, of having work or employment. Income really is the issue. That I would have a real job if I was booked that far out. And that's actually, you've given a wonderful metaphor, because I was just as scared, you know. I thought, oh, my God, how am I going to do this?
Well, I have found that job security starts and ends with your left and right foot, that you are your own security.
Yeah.
You
yeah.
actually do work for yourself, whether
yeah.
you work for a corporation or whether you work for a mom-and-pop shop. In your book, Under the Divinity Test, you actually quote Rudyard Kipling, and it's a really neat quote. I think it's taken from Jungle Book, but I'm not sure. If you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you, if you can trust yourself when all men doubt you, but make allowances for their doubting too, that's kind of the divinity test.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how many men out there have had their spouses say, you're crazy. Usually it's the mother-in-law that says, why don't you go out and get a real job? And I don't know. I don't think that that's the purpose of life. I think the purpose of life is to discover your dream and then move yourself, if that's what it takes, out of the way so that you can accomplish it.
Well, that's true, but we also seek that which is familiar for the sake of trying to feel what it feels like to be safe. you know, when we come out from God, there's this element of us that knows that we're not with God. And that aspect of us makes us feel not safe. And when we reconnect with God through the Merkaba, it literally builds the safety connection back in place. And it's that safety then that allows us to manifest much easier and allows us to be loving and supportive of others much easier. And the idea that we're going to make that connection and then we're going to be like the trapeze artist that's hanging by a thread, and it's all like hanging in the balance, if even only for a brief second, to prove that we know we can do it. And it's that is what is the thread of mastery of God that becomes present in our 3D world. Because I believe that one of the things we are doing is we are becoming more of our God self in every moment, and that would be the goal, to bring in our divinity right where we are.
Wow, that's amazing, that we can not only recognize but grow the divinity in ourselves,
mm-hmm.
that we are valuable, functional creators in the universe.
The traditional version of heaven is what I call 5D, the fifth dimensional self. And so any childhood version we have of heaven where we're perfect, our bodies are perfect, all the relationships are perfect, that's the fifth dimensional self. And why couldn't we have that right where we are in on the earth now?
I don't see any reason why not.
Exactly. And the Merkaba helps us do that. Sooner, easier, faster, better.
I believe it does. I know life now before and after learning Merkaba. And, you know, the struggle of trying to, without that tool, put yourself in an energy state or access an energy state that allows you to push a thought out into reality, it's kind of random, it's kind of individual. But when you have the tool of Merkaba, you now have something that allows you almost at will to put yourself in kind of a God consciousness.
Exactly. You have access to the blueprint. And the Merkaba is highly accurate in the now. So it is the full expression of who we are at our divine state in our physical bodies. It will keep you tuned to the present. You know, I once asked my higher self with the Merkaba, what would be a logical reason on why we would follow the higher self? Because I felt that if I could come up with a logical reason, that all those left brain types who are really looking for logic, they get it. And so the message that I got was that the logical reason to follow your higher self is that it's giving you the latest breaking news about now. So the metaphor, you know, you're watching a movie on a network TV, there's a terrible storm outside, the weatherman cuts in and says, we interrupt this program to give you the latest breaking news. So when your Merkaba comes in, or when your higher self comes in through your connection with the Merkaba, higher self comes in and gives you some new piece of information to do something differently than you had intended to do or than you've always done, and it's clear you'll do it because it's the latest breaking news on this experience that I'm having right now.
Exactly right.
I have a great little story about a woman, true story about a woman in her 50s, who got her black belt in karate. And at that point, she's going every week for her training sessions, which happened to be at 9 o'clock in the morning on Monday morning. And in one particular week, she decided she wanted to talk to the sensei, the teacher, and planned on leaving a half an hour early so she would have a full 30 minutes with him. The drive takes an hour. There were three exits that she could take off the freeway at the next city that she went to. First exit was actually closer in miles, but longer because of city traffic. Second exit was shorter in time, but longer in distance because it went around the city, but back in, a back way, out of traffic. Third way was completely out of the way. On her drive there, she got a message from her higher self telling her to get off at the first exit. She used her logic and thought, you know, I really want a full 30 minutes, so in case he's busy, he'll make time for me. So she dismissed the idea to get off at the first exit. Three times she got the message. Each time she dismissed it. Drove past the first exit, got to the second exit. There were men working, and she could not get off. So she had to go to the third exit. By the time she got to the studio, she was late. When she walked in, the sensei did speak to her and told her to do 50 push-ups in front of everyone.
Almost that exact same thing happened to me. You know, some people talk about this still small voice, spirit that talks to them. Sometimes it's in their voice, sometimes it's in another voice. And this resonance, this energy connection with, in physics we call it entangled particles, where we pick particles or ions off of larger molecules and move them apart, and then electromagnetically we alter their spin. Instantaneously, the parent particles or the entangled particles reverse spin at the same time.
Interesting.
We actually have six beryllium ions headed for deep space right now on an experiment for long-range sensing. And their sister particles are still here on Earth.
Oh, I love it.
And when their states are changed out in space, and it's going at a rate, I don't know, somewhere around 25,000 miles an hour out into deep space, their sister particles here on Earth change state on a regular basis.
Oh.
So I see the advent of what I've termed the beryllium ion modem. This is a binary remote sensor that can be anywhere in the universe, and we can see instantaneously anywhere in the universe. I can think of two little rovers running around on Mars right now that could use a couple of modems like that.
Mm.
But this synchronicity does not necessarily have to be from the disassembly of a molecule. I think it can be in the division of biological systems and even spiritual systems,
mm-hmm.
that spirits can be tied together across time and space, and that they can instantaneously sense what is going on one to another and communicate that.
I have many examples of that. I totally agree with you. And I think everyone has. You know, I regularly travel to remote places from my home in Wisconsin, and I can tell you that family members have experiences that accurately reflect what's going on for me at the time.
Wow.
Yeah.
And I've heard of twins doing the same thing. I've heard of spouses doing the same thing, brothers and sisters doing the same thing. And, of course, that's real time. That's both people alive.
Uh-huh.
We don't know what happens or where the soul goes once it leaves this physical existence. It may, as many believe, as one of my favorite authors believes, it may recycle back here again for another mortal experience to go to the next level. And it may even move from world to world so that we can bring experiences from past experience or past lessons to here. I don't know. That's maybe another show. We've discussed these tools in the genie system. We've discussed making a movie. We've discussed applying emotional energy. We've discussed synchronicity in the toolbox for this genie that's within us. Is there something we haven't covered that you want to mention the last
time? Sure. I'd love to share a couple of little tricks for people that are kind of fun. One of them is called twofers. And twofers is a system where anytime you have a thought that is counterproductive to what it is you really desire, you know, a lot of positive thinking teachers say, you know, don't think negative thoughts. But in my experience, the negative thought's already in my head before I even discover it's a negative thought. So how am I going to not think it? So the solution is to follow any negative thought with two positives. So in a simple example, if you hate your job, there's got to be at least two things that you could say you liked about your job. I get paid. I get vacation. Or I like my coworkers. But it has to be in alignment. If you said, I hate my job, but I love my husband and my son, that doesn't really undo the damage of I hate my job. So when you do the twofers, the first positive negates or cancels out the negative, and then the second becomes the seed. So you would always do it in response to any negative thought you have. Then the next thing is a very poignant example that happened to me. I used to explain to people about how you could program your Merkaba to remind you to do the Merkaba, so that if you got in a practice of doing it every day and then skipped a day or two, you would be notified, wait, your Merkaba is not going to be active anymore and you need to do it again. And my phrase was, if you have a day from hell and you're not doing your practice. Well, I don't talk that way. I don't talk that way about myself, even though in the class I used it as a metaphor. One day I was coming home from a overnight flight, and that very same day I was getting on a plane going in another direction to the East Coast, from the West Coast to the East Coast. But I was going to be home for a couple hours, repack my suitcase, and then get back on a plane. When I got off the plane coming from the West Coast, one of the employees at United recognized me and said, hi, Maureen, how are you doing? And I said, I'm doing great, considering that this is my day from hell, and I got to be back here in 2 hours to get on another plane. And as soon as those words came out of my mouth, I thought, oh, my God, what did I just say? So I immediately made a correction and said, but this is my day of heaven on earth because I'm flying with United. We both laughed, and we each went our ways. I came home, and there was a half an inch of water on my basement floor. A pipe had broken between the walls. We had to discover what it was. My neighbor came over, who happened to be home. He's off and gone. Turned off the water. The plumber came within an hour, like he said he would. He only charged me like $150. I was able to get the airline to agree to put me on a later flight. I was coming home from the bank and did all my errands, was repacked, everything ready to go, walked in the house, and the phone rang, and it was United. They said, you know, we're actually running a little late today, and if you catch the later flight to Chicago like you're booked on, you will miss your connections to the East Coast. Is there any way you could be on the 1 o'clock, which is now not leaving until 2 o'clock? I made my original flight. And when I asked my higher self through, you know, through this connection with the Merkaba, what was going on? How did all that come together like that? I was shown the phrase, you named a day of heaven on earth. So I tell everybody, ask for a day of heaven on earth every single day. Then even if stuff happens, you're going to have some wonderful support from the universe that will help you get through it in an easy way.
Absolutely phenomenal. I cannot think of a better way to wrap up 3 hours. I can't believe 3 hours has gone by again. My guest tonight is Maureen St. Germain. Her book is You Are the Genie in the Bottle, and her website is angleangel.com. And if you want to attend a workshop that she's attending, how would they do that?
On my website, you will go to a choice that's called workshops. And if you have no idea what you want or just want to see what cities I'm in, you can go to click on that, which will give you a second menu bar, and it will say all workshops or all events, something like that. Select that, and you'll be able to see the cities I'm in. And there's lots of links back and forth on all the pages that describe the workshops, give you the schedule, the tuition fees, and everything is there for you to sign up online. And questions can always be directed to info@MaureenSt.Germain.com.
info@MaureenSt.Germain.com. Okay, and we'll have that email, and we'll have the link to her website on our website at X Squared Radio. Maureen, it has been an absolute pleasure. And I want to stay in touch with you. I definitely want to let you know how this amazing synchronistic event in D.C. turns out.
I will be thrilled and honored to be part of the hearing about it. Thank
wonderful,
you.
Wonderful. I've had a wonderful time. Thank you so much for appearing on the program.
You're welcome. Good night.
Good night. All right, Earth Explorers, that is X Squared Radio for tonight. It has been a pleasure having you here with us, and we will play our exit. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours,
send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.